Okay, so everybody got the schedule, right? We were unusually organized this time for this. What we are going to have is my good friend Bernie Carrick is going to be here all day tomorrow. So he's going to come over for the tour with his 11-year-old daughter. Actually, he lives about an hour from here, and they're going to stay all afternoon, and then. Through the evening, he's going to stay over on Saturday night. And did everybody read that bio and get a little bit of
colorful guy?
Yeah, very, very colorful. He was a high school principal, carried around a baseball bat, was turning around the high school. Remember that movie? That movie was Bernie Carrick's high school. So he grew up in Paterson, New Jersey, which. The way I drove by Paterson, where he grew up, and drove by Franklin Lakes, where he lives now. But he grew up in Paterson, New Jersey, and was a mother was a prostitute who got murdered by the time he was 9. Never had a relationship with his father. Grew up in Paterson, New Jersey, before they turned it around. By his own account, pretty much everybody that he knew in high school either ended up in prison. Or dead really by the time they were in their 20s, and that movie was set in Paterson High School and his high school, but was set past when Bernie had gone through there. So he ended up training in martial arts as a high school student, and ended up as a student of Peter Urban in New York. And if I remember the story correctly, I think it was Peter Urban who told him, "Look, you know, you're either going to go down the wrong path, or you're going to get your life turned around," and suggested he join the military, which he did. So he went into the military, became an MP in the military, was actually teaching martial arts to the Delta Force guys, and when he got out, he ended up becoming the warden of the Passaic County Prison. And then had always wanted to be a New York City police officer, ended up leaving as warden and taking a huge pay cut, by the way, leaving as warden to become a part of the NYPD. So in the way, through moving up the NYPD at one point, and he what do they call it? He had won like major citations in the NYPD. He was personally responsible for the single biggest drug bust and working with the DEA, one of the single biggest drug busts in history. But somewhere along the way, they had this up-and-coming guy who was running for mayor that nobody really knew, and they were looking for security, and he volunteered to be Rudy Giuliani's driver and security as part of NYPD. And so he and Rudy ended up as close friends. Rudy Giuliani was godfather to his kids. And so when Rudy won as mayor, he first put him in as the deputy, I think he was deputy commissioner of the prison. So he was number two in charge of the police, of the prison system. And his first big claim to fame was he completely turned around the New York City police prison system, including Rikers Island. So if you look at that little bio that I sent out, I think the violence in the prisons, the number was something like 70%. There was a 70% drop in violence. I mean, there was all kinds of stats. They completely turned around the prison system. And so then he went from being number two in the prison systems to being in charge of the prison systems. And then when the police commissioner job came open, Giuliani moved him from being in charge of the prisons to being police commissioner. And so under Giuliani, I think that New York had something like a 75% drop in violent crime. Under Bernie, it was a 25 or 30% because it was Bill Bratton, who ended up in L.A., was the first police commissioner. So under Bratton, they had like a 50% drop in crime, and then under Bernie, another 30%. So what happened next was, of course, 9/11 happened, right? So it was 9/11, the police commissioner was Bernie, obviously the mayor was Rudy Giuliani, and then Tom Von Essen was the fire in charge of the fire department. Obviously, when that happened, they won international acclaim for handling that. After Giuliani's tenure as mayor, they formed a company called Giuliani Partners. So it was Rudy Giuliani, Bernie Kerik, Tom Von Essen, and a couple of other key players, but they were doing international consulting. I think one of the big projects that Bernie was involved with is helping Mexico solve. Remember, they had that murder problem. So they had all these, if I remember, prostitutes and young women. I'm not sure they were all prostitutes, but were showing up murdered. And he was involved with that with the Giuliani partners, because their assessment was it was somebody in the police department was doing murders, for some reason or other, how it came out. But they were doing that kind of high-level consulting. He also had a contract with the King of Jordan. That was later, but along the way, he ended up as the interim interior minister of Iraq. So when we were doing the rebuilding in Iraq, they had put him over there to rebuild the police force, which is when he met the King of Jordan. But then along the way, with Giuliani partners, Rudy Giuliani was telling George Bush that the next director of Homeland Security should be Bernie, right? So they nominated him for Homeland Commissioner. Now, what happened next was the nanny that he had, remember this, the nanny problems? The nanny that he had, if I remember the story correctly, had given him a Social Security number. He was paying the taxes. Usually the problem is they're paying the nanny and they haven't withheld Social Security and so forth, right? Well, he was actually paying the taxes rather than you guys know you're supposed to do that, right? If it's more than like $400, you're supposed to 1099 them, you know. So, like my housekeeper who gets about $1,000 a month, I should be 1099ing her, or I should be with those. But he was actually withholding the Social Security, withholding the taxes. But it turned out the Social Security number she gave him wasn't accurate. Now, anybody in here have a good mechanism for figuring out if somebody gave you the wrong Social Security number? You can now, right? Because they have the, what do they call it?
There's a number that you can call. For years they've had it. You call a number and you verify Social Security number.
Yeah, e-verify. That's what I was thinking about. But anyway, so it turned out that he was paying the nanny on a Social Security number that didn't exist, right? So now the whole thing imploded, right? But what was happening at the time, if you remember the context, is Rudy Giuliani was running for president, right? And so now what happened was it all piled, you know, it all kept piling on. So it went from having the wrong Social Security number to he hadn't paid taxes on a condo renovation, and the whole thing just escalated. And by the time it was all said and done, he ended up with, in New Jersey, going and making a deal with the prosecutor where he paid him like $250,000 and one thing or another, and they went away. And then the feds prosecuted him for the same thing, right? So you guys know about the idea of double jeopardy, right? Well, double jeopardy doesn't mean that the state, local, and feds can't all prosecute you for the same thing. What it means is one of them can't prosecute you for something, and then after it's adjudicated, go back and try it again. Does that make sense? So he got prosecuted at the state level, but then the feds went after him for the same thing, right? Now, the way I've heard the story from Bernie, although I don't remember the details, is it was somewhere along the line where they had drained about $5 million illegal in fighting him, that he finally said, okay, you know, I give, let's make a deal. And they put him in jail for 30 months, right? So he ended up in jail for 30 months, but the real big deal in all that stuff is the $5 million illegal, whatever the number ended up being, but it was a lot, in trying to fight the deal. Plus then, not being able to do the business he was doing, because his business, Kerik and Associates, basically was doing the same thing as Giuliani Partners, right? So at the time that they did all this, he had a contract with the King of Jordan, and he also had a contract with the United Arab Emirates. And with the King of Jordan, he was building their prison system and also doing a police training facility. So he's got, as you said, a colorful background. prison, I think it's been 18 months. It was, well, no, it's been less than that. It was October last year, right? So I believe it was released on house arrest and then actually released completely last October. So all of this has transpired over the last 4 years, in all honesty. So he's now in the process of obviously making a career comeback. And so he has the next autobiography. I mean, his first autobiography was a bestseller. It was actually already done, written, in the can, set for publication before 9/11 happened. So it was the first autobiography of any of the players that came out after 9/11. There was some criticism of that, but it had already been in the can for a year, right? So it wasn't like they rushed to put the book together, you know, post 9/11. The book was already done by Judith Regan and was published thereafter. But his next autobiography, the follow-up, is coming out in March. It's already written in the publication. But if you watch, like, cable news and so forth, the last 4 or 5 weeks, he's been constantly on Fox, MSNBC, on even Al Jazeera. Yesterday he was on Newsmax. He was on CNN a lot. And usually it's either as an expert with regard to policing. So when all the stuff was going on in Ferguson, he was constantly being interviewed and on there on the body cameras and the different things going on in the Ferguson thing. Plus, of course, his experience with 9/11 in Iraq. So he's constantly being interviewed and brought in on the ISIS thing, right? But we're going to have him here probably, you know, doing probably three hours tomorrow with us on high-level leadership development. And I think it'll be really interesting. Any questions or thoughts about his background before we are able to put it to him directly?
No, but I just wonder, what about the $5 million?
Which, legal?
Yeah.
Gone in the sands of time.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I was at his house one time, and his month's legal bill had come in, and it was $330,000. I think that number's right. It was, you know, a while back. But, you know, I mean, the ultimately, you know, his project in the last year has been mostly to do, he's done Senate hearings and congressional hearings and one thing or another, but it's on the problem we have currently in the criminal justice system, right? And, you know, if you take him specifically out of the context, if you take somebody who's an executive somewhere, and in fact, my only bitch that I've come across that I had with Rudy Giuliani was the fact that he had prosecuted, what's his name, Michael Milliken. Mm. Remember when Milliken, the junk bond guy?
Yeah.
The prosecutor for Milliken was Rudy Giuliani, right? And that was my only bitch about Giuliani's record, is Milliken never should have been prosecuted, right? Is you can't be in that industry without daily making some level of technical violations, right? And here was ultimately what they chased Bernie down at, and got two guilty pleas out of him at a state level and a federal level. When he was second in command of the prison system, his high school friend was in the construction business. So they were going to buy and flip condos, right? I mean, that's, you know, and at the time, that was, you know, it was before the real estate crash, right? So they were going to buy and flip condos, right? So they bought the first condo, and his friend in the construction business was doing the construction on the condo. And then they sold the condo. But they were saying that he never reported to the IRS the level of contribution that his friend made on the thing of on the condo, and never reported that as income. Right? Now, I've done the same thing, you know, past the statute of limitations. But see if this scenario. Had a student, bought a house. The house was, I think, 2,500 square feet with 1,300 square foot unfinished. The student is a contractor, so he did it on trade out, and did the build out, and then I sold the house at a $50,000 gain or something like that, right? So I never reported the tax. Now, I reported the tax on the capital gains. Never would have dawned on me to report the tax on the trade, right, on the barter piece of it. Okay. Well, that's what Bernie did. Except it was, they were partners, right? So when they sold the thing, they reported the capital gains. There was nothing hidden there. But they're saying that it was tax fraud because he never reported the tax, or he never reported taxable income from the contribution between the difference in what the retail was of the construction and what his friend's company charged the project, right? And now when Giuliani was running for president, they tried to make it like a big corruption deal, right? So the friend was from Paterson, New Jersey, and they, you know, there were somewhere along the line, there were mob connections with the, I mean, they tried to make it like it was a corruption deal. But the reality was, it was like got him on a tax deal, right? But then the federal prosecutor, since everybody was trying, the other side was trying to make Giuliani look bad, was looking for a way to make Giuliani look bad, and Bernie was the natural target. So then they went after him on the federal level for the same thing as the local level, right? Well, and by the way, they got him for another felony. You know what that was? Lying to the White House. Well, what that was, and you know, feel free to ask him, but what it was is when they nominated for Homeland Security, they said, have you committed any felonies? Is there anything that, you know, is going to embarrass the White House? Well, he said, no, not that I know of, right? And then when they started going after him for the tax problem and the nanny Social Security number, they said, well, that was a lie because you had these other things in the thing. So they and it's a felony. So they prosecuted him for lying on the application that he didn't have that in the background, which he didn't know he had in the background until, right? So, you know, from the standpoint of a colorful background, he's got a colorful background.
But didn't he say, yeah, I did things not exactly according to Hoyle when I was having all that success with the prison system, et cetera. I shouldn't have done certain things certain ways. Wasn't there other stuff besides these two things he didn't know about that he said he regretted?
Feel free to ask.
Oh, okay.
as I recall the stories, not that I can come up with, right? You know, the problem ultimately we all have with the legal system is if you get on the wrong side of a state or federal prosecutor, they have an unlimited budget, right? And there's nobody in the room that hasn't done something that could have been prosecuted as a felony, right? And it just doesn't matter how clean you are, right? If somewhere along the line, you know, you misstated income on a credit card application, which is federal, you know, a federal felony, or you know, somewhere along the line, the I's weren't dotted and T's weren't crossed. So if you start looking deeply enough, you know, there's something, right? And I use the Milliken thing as an example to beat up on Rudy Giuliani for a second, is in Milliken's case, he was dealing with hundreds of transactions a day. And they got him on a couple of technical violations, right? But we have this law that was put in place to prosecute the mafia, which Giuliani did quite successfully, called RICO. Everybody familiar with RICO? Here's what RICO means. The prosecutor can say, nobody's proven that you did anything, but we're going to take all your assets right now because we're accusing you of something. So we're going to take your house, your boat, your cars, your all your cash, and you're now going to be broke and assetless on the street fighting us with unlimited deep pockets. Good luck. Okay? They can do that at any time. Okay? So that was the conversation that they had with Milliken. Is yes, you're worth $250 million. You know, you're worth $250 million. We're going to take all your assets, and good luck fighting us because we have unlimited pockets. Or you can go to a club fed for 30 months and pay us $100 million out of the $250 million, right? So that was the Milliken deal. Long before I ever met Bernie, I was pissed off that they prosecuted Milliken. You know, because Milliken was doing tons of good stuff for the economy, The only thing he did wrong was he made a lot of money and pissed enough people off that he was making too much money that they chased him down for it. But yeah, so that's tomorrow. We should probably close those doors.
I get it.
So tomorrow afternoon.
Tomorrow afternoon, yeah. Okay. Yeah, tomorrow our schedule is we're in the room next door. Yeah, don't. We didn't want to be in here permanently.
There is
like a normal door over there,
okay,
so we should be
safe. We can get out.
Yeah,
but we can still watch the view, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. While we drag all the stars,
have meals delivered right now.
Porta potty.
Oh, that might be a problem.
Yeah, that would be bad. Where were we? Oh, the interesting story that Bernie told me one time that I thought was instructive is here's the scenario. He's the interim minister in Iraq, right? And he has basically been tasked with the Bush administration of go start developing interior minister. Basically go start developing their police force, right? And, of course, we were at the same time trying to rebuild their army, we're trying to rebuild the police, and there were all kinds of problems involved with that. But he's over there trying to rebuild the police force, and the question I had asked him when we had him in Breckenridge at one of our events is I said, well, how did you get your head around going from being like high school dropout MP to, you know, this level you were at the Interior Ministry? I said, how'd you get your arms around that, right? Because every step in his career, he went from like here to here, and then here to here, and there weren't like increments, right? You know, we think of like the ladder of success and this stuff, but mostly it was, you know, he went from nothing to here, then a big jump, then to here, then a big jump, then another jump, then a big jump, and another big jump. And his comment was, he said, well, let me tell you a story that illustrates it. He says, never assume that anybody at a higher level than you is any smarter than you are, right? Because they're just human beings. And we all have a tendency to think that they're way up there and therefore they're a lot smarter, a lot more educated, a lot more on top of things. And he said, but that, you know, it's dawned on me several times over the years, that's not true, just through whatever circumstances they ended up there. And his example was, they're in Iraq, and they're going to go meet the King of Jordan, right? And so they have this trip lined up to meet the King of Jordan to ask for help in various ways, right? So they have the gentleman who's going to be going with them, and I forget his role, but I think he's the ambassador in Iraq. He was formerly the ambassador to France, and they have Bernie, and they have all of the key people that are running Iraq, who are going to go meet directly with King of Jordan, and so forth, right? So he says they have a meeting with all the key people before the trip, and he thinks the meeting should be, what are we trying to accomplish, what do we want him to do, what's our outcomes? And he says it basically turns into be, show up at this time, the plane's going to leave at this time, here's how long we're going to be, and be sure and bring, you know, it's basically about the travel itinerary. He goes, well, okay, these are all people who are smarter and been in these places longer than I have. Obviously, they already know what they're trying to accomplish. And he says they go sit in a room like this, meeting with the King of Jordan directly, and they go through the ministers of different pieces and the ambassador. And basically, he says he's shocked because each of them are just kind of telling the king what they're doing and hadn't come with an agenda or an outcome that they're trying to accomplish, right? And he said in his case, their big problem with developing the police force is they had no infrastructure. And so what he's trying to do is he wants the King of Jordan for the U.S. to partner with Jordan and to build a police training facility where all the police can be trained in Jordan and then bring them back to Iraq, and they, you know, they have a budget of whatever it is, $150 million or so forth, And his agenda is, let's get Jordan and the U.S. for Iraq to partner with building a police training facility. Jordan needs it. Iraq needs it. Jordan's in a place where they can create the infrastructure we can fund it for him. So that's his objective. But he said in the entire meeting, he was the only one that came into it with an objective of what they wanted to get an outcome to be. Right? So, the lesson is, at each level up, it's not necessarily that they're better prepared, are more intelligent and so forth. It's just figuring out how to get to that point to begin with and then maximizing. Does that make sense? So, I always thought that was an interesting story. But anyway, so what in today, what would be the biggest burning issues we have in the room? I've been trying to browbeat Greg over here on rotating curriculum. Who in here is, in fact, using a rotating curriculum in your school? And is anybody other than Greg not? Is Croft set up that way?
Not really.
Not really.
No.
It's not so much set up as it's even a curriculum, really. But
it's a curriculum that we're handed.
Yeah.
Which is very front-loaded.
Yeah. So pretty much all of the different movement you're learning in the first 6 months. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
No, but it's too front-loaded, though.
Right, yeah. But everybody else but Greg, and you have a bunch of different curriculums, Jeff.
With some of the stuff we're doing, we have rotating curriculum, and then some of it we don't.
Right. What are the types of things you're not doing at all?
The Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu,
okay.
The Tai Chi.
Okay.
Could you talk loud?
Yeah, it's the AC outlet right there is really noisy. We could just tighten this up. We've got this huge ass. I think the way they've got it set up is we've got way too much room today and Sunday and way too little room tomorrow.
That'd be the way to do it.
Yeah. Well, at our point where we have the peak numbers, we're going to be like sardines, I think. We haven't been able to. We're in the half Arnold room tomorrow, which is right there. But by the way, the only problem we have with this facility, a lot of them like this, is they have a lot of weddings, right? So in order for us to run past 5 o'clock, we've got to, right? So they'll have all these rooms available until 5, and then all of a sudden there's weddings and rehearsals. And
they're done then.
Yeah, exactly. We actually had that one time where nobody thought about it ahead of time. So they kicked us out at 5, and we went somewhere else to try to keep our momentum going so we didn't have to be done. But you're not doing it with the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Eric and I are going to be here. I wonder if they're lost in translation somewhere.
You said they'll be here around noon.
Oh, around noon. Okay. It'd be a good question to ask Eric how they're dealing with that within Brazilian structure. Greg, you got a bunch of people here who are doing it. Did you have some other questions on things that you?
I think most of them kind of answered.
Yeah.
I guess at this point, probably going to be the logistics of implementing it now that I've already kind of got the system in place.
Yeah.
So any advice on if you were doing it old school and then you started, how did you transition and how did you make that transition smoothly?
The easiest way to start, you teach classes already. Then do your class, write down what you taught. And then a week, now you got 1 week curriculum. Do it for a month. Now you got a month, you rotate it through. Do it for 3 months, and now you have your curriculum. You know what you got to teach, and you know what you do teach. You just got to write it down. You know, once you get it down, then teach your staff how to teach it the way you want it. That's how we establish ours in the beginning. It's like, how do we start? The advice we got is like, finish class, have your instructors write down what they taught, the drills they did, everything like that. Then just do it, and once you get it, now you got a rough draft. And then we sat down on a spreadsheet, put them all in, we plugged, this doesn't go good, this drill goes better here, and then we massaged it, next thing you know, we had it, and we have a rotating curriculum, then we did it for our fundamentals, our intermediate, and then we had advanced. And once we did that, then we shot all the videos for it, so now You have online instruction if you wanna, in your upgrade package, you can go and visit your, you know, oh, you upgrade and you get access to the, not only this handwritten curriculum when you join, but, you know, video curriculum.
And that is in the context of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, we've had that for, man, we've shot so much, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we've always redone it, and now it's like, man, we have all this content.
Yeah.
So we put it on our, the Black Belt
right.
website we created.
Yeah.
So now we got three sections on our Black Belt website, you know, fundamental. You join, you get access to that. Upgrade, you get intermediate. Upgrade higher, then you get, you know, access to all of it from
yeah.
beginning to advantage.
In your case, Greg, you've got a real thoroughly laid out curriculum. It's just how do you transition smoothly, and the transition is pretty easy because what are you doing? White, gold, what are your belt levels?
And we keep white separate, so it's just white. And we gold, orange.
Okay.
Green, purple.
Okay.
Pretty much all the way up. Blue, high blue, and then we do red through black right now, just because we don't have a lot.
Well, but let's just take this, right? So if you, what we're doing is white and gold is the but here's what we're doing right now is white belt, gold belt, more or less two months, right? So now there's two month chunks, right? So it just rotates through that. Right, and so that's the basic level. So if they enroll for the initial year without ever renewing, they never get out of that. Okay, so they're now in the basic class and they're just rotating through that curriculum. So now they keep getting orange, green, purple, and so forth, but they just never leave that class. Right, so yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute. But then once they renew. Then they go into level one class, which is this, right? So it's now orange, green, purple, blue, which we just did a bunch of other intermediate levels, but let's just say that's it, right? So now that's each module is 2 months. So there's 4 2-month modules that rotate, right?
You keep those in the same class?
What's that?
Those are all in one class?
Yeah. Well, we're doing a level one, and then a level two, and then a level three. And this is four belt levels, this is four belt levels, and this is brown black, basically, okay? But then what happens is when you want to implement it, right? So if you take, whether you put this here or keep it here, right? When you implement it, so you've got what these guys are learning, what they're learning, and like on forms, what are you doing? Chenji Tang and Tosan Wan Yo?
That's right.
Right? Okay. So what you do is when you do it, you just start doing Wan Yo here, and that's your first module, right? And then you do Tosan as your second module, and then you do Tangoon as your third module, and then you do Chunji as your fourth module, and you just rotate it backwards, right? Because now what happens is no one in this class is going to complain about suddenly they learned the highest level material, right? And at the highest level, they've already learned this stuff, right? So you're now at the highest level, you're teaching them what they're going to be teaching, learning now anyway. Does that make sense? And so then they learn that module, next test, they move into the next class, right? Then the next group, they learn this. Then the next group, they learn this. And then you're back to this. And by the time you're done with the rotation, nobody has repeated anything.
And that's only necessary if you're starting the school
the
that you've
time.
Already started.
Yeah.
But if you're starting school from scratch, you could rotate in any
yeah,
direction.
Yeah, you can do it any way you want it, right? But this is just to convert the existing people, right?
I guess the other thing that I'm unclear of is how do you chunk if you're are leadership in level one in that group right there, are they allowed to come, are you limiting their classes to twice a week or
No, they can come as often as they want.
See, the challenge that I'm having when I put four belts in one group is we have class sizes that are way too big.
No, no, but you've got more classes per group, though, too, right now.
Yeah, you did, so, what you just did is if you're doing two belts in a class, and now you do this, you just can double the number of classes.
Now they have twice as many options to come in.
Yeah.
So your class size is going to average out to the same, but you're going to have a lot more flexibility for your students.
But they're going to be a 400% easier to teach.
So right now we have six classes a week for those two.
Six each, so six of one, six of another?
Yeah, I'm chunking it.
Okay, so now you're going to have, you theoretically could have 12, but probably you can reduce it to 8, so you'll have less classes, there'll be more flexibility, your students will have 8 choices. Now they can choose more classes, but your class size will stay the same.
Yeah.
The other thing I was going to say, if I could add something on to the whole concept of what to do, how they're going to transition, how they're, you know, there's, we worry a lot, and I'm he knows I'm really anal. I have, like, when I do a transition, maybe I have a document that shows them exactly what's going on, and there's Q&A and all this stuff, and, you know, and I've spent a lot of time setting it up for them, and it's all written down, and, you know, Mrs. Minton and Master Minton know, you know, some of the stuff I've written. It's all written down. It's, like, really laid out. And, you know, I don't think any of that matters. I think if the next day you start teaching classes this way, you're the instructor, you're the boss. You know, you're wearing a black belt, and they're just going to do what you say. And a lot of this, we worry about a lot of these things, and I think the best way to do something like this is, you know, like, decide you're going to do it Monday. Don't spend too much time trying to pre-plan stuff and just do it, because there's nothing it's not going to help. They're going to follow your lead because you're the leader. And if there's a problem with the implementation, there might be a problem with how the classes are being taught more than there's a curriculum or an implementation issue. You know, if my parents come and complain to us about something, I've never had a case where that's actually been because we did something wrong. It's because maybe we didn't communicate it well. But I wouldn't overdo it.
Yeah.
The rotating curriculum, I tried before, a couple of years ago. But I was challenged. My challenge was students not missing, so they missed the change it to the next cycle, and then they have to wait like 2-3 months. So those students are kind of challenging for me, so that was difficult handed to when they miss.
They miss, there's four sets of curriculum, they miss one. Right. Now they got to wait like all the way around to get that curriculum?
For the test, they have to wait for like 3 months if they miss the cycle.
So I've got a test coming up. Let's take the example I was using with Greg. We went to grandmother's for a month.
Right.
Yeah. Now I've got a 2 month cycle, and now and that's the argument for a 2 month cycle rather than a 3 month cycle. Mm-hmm. By the way, it just makes it easier to keep people from falling behind. But now I've got a 3 month cycle and I fell behind, and it. Versus doing a test every month is it makes it harder to catch them up, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And how do you deal with that?
Were you asking me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we just have 2 month cycles, and if they miss time, it was the same as the old way, though. I don't think that rotating curriculum or not rotating curriculum matters. You know,
here's where I can understand what you're saying. Is let's say the old way was, it's a 3 month test cycle, 24 to 30 lessons, but you're doing a test every month. So there's October test, November test, December test, right? Mm-hmm. And now I missed a month of lessons. I have to get you caught up, but now instead of testing in October, you test in November and you're back on track, right? But now if I was doing 3 month blocks, and you missed a month and you're not quite ready for this, right? Now I've got the issue of you missed some of this curriculum, and the next test isn't until October, November, December, January. So in essence, I'm pushing you off a full quarter on testing. Right?
Yeah, but again, we're doing it every 2 months, so that's really not, if somebody misses a month,
yeah.
It, or 3 weeks. We actually
then they test in 3 months rather than 2 months, and you're fine.
Right, and we have the policies and procedures that we've sent out to everybody that also tells them when they join, if they miss less than 2 weeks, we expect them to take extra classes before and after. They don't always do that, but we tell them that at the beginning, yeah. So nobody's disappointed. And if they miss more than 2 weeks, we do it for another reason. We say we add time onto the end of their program, and we'll expect them to test the next time. But we also do that at the front so that if they say, well, I'm going to miss a month, can I not pay this month? We say, well, no.
Yeah.
You know, we explained how that works. We add the time onto the end of your program. There's no time missed, and we want to make sure we plan for your next testing. And that really stops the conversation about, can I freeze my membership for a month while we're in Hawaii?
You know, even worse. So I was, which I must have been really bored to even look at it, but, you know, there was some this martial arts business discussion group going on Facebook, right? And so there's, I don't remember who it was, but, you know, some Tom Callis type devotee who I decided I'd never sue anybody for contracts, so I stopped doing contracts. So basically, you know, he's charging $120 a month, and so you pay $120 the first month, and you pay month to month. And he goes, but I haven't figured out how to stop from getting hit so bad over the summer because everybody wants to cancel for 2 months, right? Mm-hmm. Well, he doesn't have a contract. He doesn't have a down payment. So, you know, I mean, the whole health club logic for a down payment for an initiation fee was as long as you pay your monthly payment, you're fine, and if you stop, then when you start again, you have to pay the initiation fee over again, right? So he doesn't have an enrollment fee, and he doesn't have a contract, and he doesn't have anything else. So basically, if they say, I want to pay this month, not pay next month, won't be here next month, want to come back, you know, they're screwed. And it's all these unintended consequences. People do this kind of stupid self-righteous stuff, and then they build themselves into a box where they get, all kinds of bad things happen, right?
Sir,
yeah.
Can I just add to that? Because I'm in a very traditional style, Tong Sidel, and I've been doing rotating curriculum now for about 5 years. And so technically that could happen, because say we teach one form in one set, they would technically have to wait a year before they get that
get back
again.
To it, yeah.
But it's never been a problem. Rotating curriculum has been the best thing that we've ever done. Because what we do is when they come in, say they've missed all summer because they were off with their dad up north, so what we'll do is we'll just catch them up, or we'll encourage them to do a few private lessons, and we usually get them caught up pretty quickly. We get them to work with each other and help, and then so they don't have to wait any longer. But it's really no different if they lost 2 months without rotating curriculum. We found it a very, very minimal problem, considering all the benefits of rotating curriculum.
Yeah, let me add on to that. Like, if you had form one, like a curriculum set 1, 2, 3, 4, ABC, whatever it is, or maybe they're forms or whatever they are, and there's four of them, and they miss one, we just have them take the next cycle. We don't, if they never get that form again, it's not the end of the world. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to create a really good black belt. So I don't worry about they missed that set of stuff, because we're training on all that stuff anyway. So, you know, if we get too ego, somebody used the word the other day, traditional, or not that long ago, traditional, like it's traditional. But most of this stuff wasn't traditional, like, I don't know, it didn't come down from God or anything it didn't come over from the Mayflower to the United States. I mean,
most of it they weren't doing in the 50s.
Yeah, exactly.
What people think is traditional is like what I did in the 70s or the 80s.
Yeah, the word traditional means what I grew up with.
Yeah.
And that's not really, that doesn't mean it was the best. I mean, you know, maybe our... It's like, I'm going to parent the way my parents did. Maybe that's not the best way, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, they used to hit you or whatever. Not me, but...
Well, I tried to have, you know, one of the many times I had Jun Rhee at one of our events, I sat down and said, this is all of our students, and you've never really done the history and the stuff, and why don't we talk about Taekwondo in Korea and how it was working and, you know, and how the teachers taught and stuff. And his response shouldn't have shocked me, but it did. He said, I don't want to talk about any of those guys. They were all like idiots and lowlifes and criminals. And he goes, my father didn't want me to train in Taekwondo. I had to sneak off and do it behind his back because it was mostly underworld, right? So, you know, I mean, his respect for, like, Taekwondo in Korea in the 30s, 40s, and 50s was non-existent, right? So many times we have this, like, strange idea that, like, the guys who made this stuff up in the 1800s or 1900s were somehow geniuses, and, you know, PhDs in education, and they, you know, no, they, you know, most of them were like blue-collar laborers who were, you know, learning some better way to fight, right?
And they weren't teaching kids,
yeah.
And they weren't teaching people over 25, and they
yeah.
weren't, you know, and we're, you know, if,
exactly.
if you want a narrow market like that, then that you could probably
yeah.
do it that way.
Yeah, if you're just doing, you know, like in Korea, if you're just teaching the army guys, right? So, but go back to what you just said, Jamie. You brought something up there. Is what we do now is at the transition from what we're calling level one to level two, and from level two to level three, is there's now a comprehensive test. And truthfully, it's more up in the higher levels, right? But prior to black belt, we do what we call a black belt prep cycle, which basically is a review over all the curriculum. So if there's something they missed down here, they're going to get it here, right? So they're not going to test the black belt without being proficient in any and everything. But if somehow they were gone during the module that they did Tangu, well, the classes still do it, right? So think about it this way, Greg. So now, in your case, I'm teaching one yo here to everybody. Well, next cycle, I can be working with everybody on one yo and tosan, right? Three quarters of the class knows that, so I can still be doing review and drill and all the curriculum back to where they know, right? And when I then run the test, so if I'm testing from whatever it is, blue to red, I can have the blue to red have to be able to test the one, you know, Tangoon, Tosan, Chunji. I did it backwards, but you get the idea. So every test can be cumulative for everything that person has learned to date, right? And certainly at the break points where they move from one class to the other, that can be comprehensive, right? So you really don't lose anything. And truthfully, I like the way you said it better, which is, I missed a piece of curriculum down here, so what? You know, I'll catch back up with it sooner or later anyway. It's not like it's a crisis, right? Hell, I was at Junior Institute. I was teaching a bunch of forms that I had never learned myself as a student, because there were periods of time when they just didn't, you know, teach them. So it just didn't make that much difference.
Yeah, and I think the thing, if we're getting into curriculum, is make sure what our outcome is. In the education system, I mean, what they're supposed to be trying to do is now have these common core outcomes. They have these outcomes that they're supposed to want to learn. And what we want to do is make sure that they can. The question is, do we want them to have a bunch of stuff memorized, or do we want them to be really good at whatever martial art you have, at kicking or punching or jujitsu, or you want them to be good at that at the end? So really, that's our main underlying goal. And because maybe we learned it a certain way through forms or through another system or through a different order of curriculum, we learned this move first or that move first, we think that's the way it has to be. But what we want to, if we look at what the outcome is supposed to be, like my outcome is that when they're black belts, when they test for their black belt, they're really good and they actually know how to apply the moves. They can use them in a self-defense situation. They can, you know, we have certain outcomes we're looking for. And so it strips away some of the stuff that maybe isn't necessary. And if you strip that stuff away and reduce the amount of volume of curriculum, another thing I just quickly mentioned, if the volume of curriculum is down, quality has to go up. If people often mix those up. They think that they have to increase volume of curriculum to increase quality, and that's the opposite, because you're only going to have these people 2 days a week. I mean, it's not like increased volume and people all of a sudden come 5 days a week. So volume of curriculum, it's like I can either fill up my time with more stuff, or I can repeat that stuff more. If I repeat that stuff more, my quality goes up. So that's the equation that you got to balance. And so the rotating curriculum allows you to reduce the volume of curriculum usually too. And really, I'd encourage everybody to strip away stuff that's not necessary.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and that's true if you're fighting, if you're learning to fight. I mean, you know.
And maybe a different way to say it is, if you're going to add stuff that's fun, entertaining, and that one level is desiring to do at the next level, don't add just more movement for its own sake.
Well, and I would expand on that. We add stuff.
Yeah.
What we've been trying to do lately in our curriculum is add stuff that's related to the other things. So, like, if they're learning a form, we add self-defense that's exactly the same thing from the form. So rather than in the old day, we were given curriculum from
yeah.
the old days where there was different self-defense. That
by somebody who wasn't a PhD in education, who had never really studied
Yeah, well, or maybe didn't teach a class that often, you know? I mean, it's not...
Well,
it doesn't require a PhD for that. But you know, so we add stuff, and
By the way, that's a commonality. That's the problem with so many organizations is the leaders in the organization stop running the school, and the further away they get from the day-to-day frontline operations, the less the curriculum has any connection with what should be going on.
It's like professors in college, too. Yeah. You know, the professors are not teaching classes or doing engineering or doing stuff, and they end up being theoretical.
Yeah, and Junior is just as bad. I mean, you know, when he ran a chain of schools, what they did with curriculum is different than he does now. But he hasn't actually been in the day-to-day front range of running a school that he owned for over 20 years. So the further distance you get from that, the less it's related to what really should be going on. But does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
And you're not going to ever hear anybody who, after going through the 2 or 3 years of pain and agony of debating with themselves, then made this shift, and some of them screwed it up, right? Screwed up the implementation and irritated some people and fluffed it up. But once it's up and running, I've never heard of anybody who said, that was the dumbest thing I ever did, I'm going back.
And we've heard lots of people say, it's the best thing I ever did, she just said that,
yeah.
I just said that, you guys can vouch, everybody can vouch for that. So,
yeah, they all say it's the best thing I ever did, I can't believe I was so stupid to have done it the other way for years, right? You know, in my case, I mean, it was 20 years of trying to run a one-room schoolhouse all the time, right? And there was all these metaphors for, you know, spinning plates and SWAT team and all the helpers. You got the leadership people coming in to help because I'm trying to teach, you know, there's 12 people in class. Theoretically, they could all be learning 12 different things, right? And it's just a completely screwed up system. Now, Greg, we have somebody trying to come in who can't.
Oh, yeah. Well, you, yeah. So. This will be the challenge to see what the...
Okay.
Just looking.
You're welcome to come join us.
These are like the doors to the dungeon.
Damn.
I know. Yeah.
You know, it's not like they have the weapons cache in here. Or something.
Maybe they used to.
Could be.
Maybe that's their backup. It's under the floor.
I don't know why you would put impenetrable doors in the front and, well, you know, doors and windows
bulletproof.
In the back.
Bulletproof.
Are they bulletproof?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm waiting. This thing looks like a castle, and we're right by the military. This might be the last stronghold
last
where they take the president to. And
okay.
So I feel much better now.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure.
They'll knock us out of the way.
Well, they had what? Dick, Colin Powell was here last week, right? And... you know, this particular hotel ends up with, you know, most of the VIPs. It's, you know, right on property. Still, the funniest thing I've seen in recent years was watching President Obama's speech from West Point and watching the cadets falling off asleep in the middle of the speech. Did you guys see that video? Can you imagine being a sophomore and getting caught? You know, I don't know what hell there was to pay for the poor kid who's been up, you know, been up for 24 hours, and he's got to be, you know, got to be attentive for the commander in chief, and he gets caught falling asleep. I would hate to be in his shoes.
On video, national.
But weren't there like 4 or 5 of them that just couldn't? And I remember hearing the backstory. It was something about how long they had made them wait and what was going on, and you know, and I think they were just having to sit in the hot room for like 5 hours.
They probably never sit down for that long in that space,
exactly.
And the whole 4 years are here.
But Greg, is that all making sense?
Yes.
But the transition is fairly easy as long as you kind of start at the top and work your way backwards, okay? Because there really isn't any big issue there. And if you stay with a 3-month cycle, that's fine. So every other premise that they've had is the same. If you tamp it down to a 2-month cycle, really they like that better because I get my belt sooner and all that other stuff. You've just got to, you know, if you're trying to teach them a form and a bunch of one steps and some sparring drills and so forth, you got to trim it down, right? Because you're not going to be able to get all that stuff done as well in 2 months, although the quality of the classroom will go up by 100%. So
Yeah, and I would add on to that. I've been working lately, it seems like, with a lot of people that are traditionally, maybe not the right word, but historically done 2-month cycles. And they've been moving it to a 3-month cycle or a 10-week cycle because they want to increase quality. And to me, that's just not understanding what's going on. What they need to do is, and that's true in school too. I mean, if you look at elementary schools, they do like midterms of a certain, they don't move their finals out, you know, so they do them every year. They do them at the 6-month borders, or the not 6-month, but half the year borders. You know, and they do that for a reason, because there's only so much stuff you really ought to shove in somebody's head before you test them on it. And so there's kind of a natural boundary there. But to expand the time that we teach stuff to correct for having too much curriculum to teach is not the right direction to go. The right direction to go is, if you can't teach it in 2 months, reduce how much, increase repetition, which means reduce volume of curriculum. That's the equation. If we know that equation, then we're going to make a lot more sense for ourselves, too. We're not going to drive ourselves nuts. I have to teach this stuff in 2 months, and I'm going nuts, and they're going nuts, and people are quitting because they, you know, they say they want to do T-ball or soccer, but really it's because they just, you know, can't keep up with everybody, and they're embarrassed or whatever happens. So, I mean, I think that's important, and probably for all of us. I mean, if every year we went through, we try to do this every year where I meet with all my staff, and we go through our curriculum, and most of what we try to do is see if we can either reduce stuff or mesh stuff together, so that when I'm teaching one thing, I'm teaching it something else. So I'm actually increasing volume of repetition and not volume of curriculum.
Repetition.
Yeah, it's the same concept you'd use if you want people to do 100 push-ups, right? You don't do it all at once. You do it over a class period. But you know, it's very easy to do that in our school. And that there's we even do like a XMA. You know, that XMA came out, and that was a big thing. And our organization, we got into it, and there were all these weird forms they do, and we just simplified it. Whatever they're doing in the regular class, they do it with music and in a little more exciting way, and it's totally different and fun, and they feel like it's exciting, and it's the same exact value, but now I'm increasing the amount of repetition I get on the same stuff that we were using. Or if we're doing some kind of sword form, it's the same as the stick form. It's exactly the same, but they feel like it's totally different. So, again, the same value, but now I increase the repetition and don't increase the volume of curriculum. So that's something to think about.
The other thing, Dominic, you're still doing the, if I'm a enrolled for a year and I'm a green belt, I'm in the same class with everybody else, but Black Belt Club gets to come to like a separate class or something, right? Right. Well, this structure, and there's different iterations of it, but this is, if you're enrolled for a year, you never move out of that class, right? And then, I'm calling it level one, but that's Black Belt Club leadership. Okay? In the same class, but scheduled as, you know, let's say 6 to 7, but 6 to 6:45, is the Black Belt Club portion of it, right? And then the last 15 minutes is the leadership portion, right? So if they're just in Black Belt Club, that's the point at which they're bowed out, right? And then there's the extra 15 minutes at the end of leadership. But, you know, what? A lot of times what's happening is the premise for why you're in Black Belt Club isn't very strong, right? And then the premise for being in the upgrade is you get to come to an extra class a week, but their problem already is that they're tight on time trying to make 2 classes a week, and now you tell me to come to a third, and the third is Thursday night at 7 or it's Saturday at 1, and it's the same day as our church thing or soccer or whatever, right? And so you've got to be very careful about that ever being the premise for why they, you know, it's okay that, you know, on your current enrollment, there's twice a week. On the new enrollment, if you want to come as often as you want, that's fine. That part's okay. But if they then feel like the proposition is, I now come 3 days a week, I now come 4 days a week, I now come 5 days a week, that's a problem, not a benefit, right? And so most of our students are not perceiving that that's a benefit. Again, no different than when I did the MBA. When I did the MBA, one of their selling points is you come one day a week. Come one day a week and you do the deal, and it's alternate Fridays and Saturdays, and you don't have to drive down here 2 or 3 days a week, right? Well, so as soon as I have like the Black Belt Club only class on Thursday night, then that becomes an objection, not a benefit, right? The second thing is this structure, which I will freely admit I stole this part from Bill Clark directly, right? You know, to my knowledge, I saw rotating curriculum developed completely independently, and there's probably a bunch of other places. But, you know, I know that Bill Clark developed it for his underbelts years ago. I didn't know about it. I developed it for our Black Belt curriculum years ago. He didn't know about it. And then years after, Dave Kovar came into a meeting and came up with, the new idea that he was so excited about, and I'd already been doing it for 12 years, right? You know, for me, when I saw Clark doing it with the beginners, it was kind of like a blinding flash of the obvious of why haven't I, you know, I've been doing this whole thing to solve a problem with our black belts. Why didn't I do it to the underbelts? Where was I going with that? I don't know. Go ahead.
I have a question. Did you say that you're keeping them 45 minutes if they're Black Belt Club and then you're dismissing them as their leadership. They say the extra.
Correct.
You're doing that now.
Exactly.
And you've been doing that for a long
forever,
time.
Forever, yeah.
Okay, we used to do it. We were at our biggest when we did it.
Yeah.
For some reason, I don't know why, we quit doing it.
I can tell you why.
You get
the instructors and you're not paying attention and they're sloppy and they don't want to stop and bow those guys out. Either because they feel like bad about telling them to go away, or they're in the middle of something, they just want to keep running, then all of a sudden the whole idea goes away, right? I mean, I've seen that happen in our schools. Is the new guy, I'm like, well, what the hell's going on, you know? You're now doing the leadership material, and you got four people. Well, I just didn't feel it. Well, no. You know, that's not the thing. And,
well, or the
and,
other.
And this piece, people will feel bad about. Well, you mean now they can get their orange belt or their green belt, but they didn't learn the same thing that these people did? Well, why the hell do I care? I mean, if they get their orange belt and they drop out, they're not going to remember what they learned 5 years from now, right? And you either have, everyone in here is either going to renew or drop out, right? And the ones that are enrolled for a year are either going to renew or drop out. So, What does it matter if you now teach them, a couple of traditional forms before they drop out, or if they just learn? And, you know, the occasional time we've had a parent who wants to be whiny about that, my conversation is, well, this is just like high school structure. Well, what do you mean? We have the VOTEC track, right? So you have the kids who aren't going to go on to college but need a career trajectory. You have the ones that are going to go on to college, and then you have the ones who are, super strong are going to go off to West Point or Harvard or something, right? So you have the IB or the AP track over here, and then you have, a lower-level college prep class, and then you have the high school graduate class, and then you have the go learn how to rebuild your engine or whatever, the technical track. There's all those tracks. This is the same way. These are all the ones who said, no, I don't want to be a black belt. I'm just going to do this for a while and drop out. And so we want to make sure they get really good at and learn how to do the stuff that they've done very well, because at least we've had an impact. It's much better to get these basics down and be really good at them than it is to... And by the way, most of the stuff you teach somebody in the first year doesn't make any damn difference until they get to the brown or black belt anyway, right? That's when they pull it all together. So you've got to get out of those kinds of hang-ups.
And if we did what I was saying before, which is our outcome at black belt is this. I mean, that's at least in jiu-jitsu you get different ranks that like it might be purple belt or some other rank. But if your outcome at a certain rank is this, then it frees you up to try to make that the best it possibly can be. Versus, I'm supposed to do it some other way. I want to make it the best I can at black belt, and then. Make it the most efficient. But the other reason, you said you did that a long time ago and it worked and now you don't do it. I don't know. The other rule seems to be if I do something really good and it worked, then I just stop doing it for some reason sometimes, I mean, and it's funny because sometimes we'll come up or we'll be talking about, hey, we did that promotion, we did that marketing, it worked really damn well. Why haven't we done that in 2 years? Nobody knows, you know. So sometimes you get success with something and you forget about it.
Well, I've been having a conversation with people recently, and they remind me of things that I did 12 years ago. It's like, oh, yeah, we did that 12 years ago. Why'd you stop? Forgot about it, you know, like I lost the system. It's a Stephen Hawking quote. All systems left on their own tend towards entropy, right? So if you're not constantly vigilant, they just start falling apart. But it makes a big difference, Greg, moving them into, making them wait to move into this class until they are, in fact, renewed, and then having a differential. The other thing that you'll find is when you're doing the leadership and Black Belt Club, you should have 75 to 90% of everyone who renews directly into the high-level program. So there's no reason in the world to make Black Belt Club be the next step and the leadership be the next step. Remember back when you were still with me, we used to do second-degree renewals, right? Well, it was just as easy to do it directly, right? That's what Master Club was. Just easy to put them directly into Master Club than it was to do Black Belt Club and then move them, right? So, and in your case, I mean, you're sitting on $250,000. I mean, literally, you could go in November or December, suck up, worst case, $150,000 cash just by hitting a big renewal blitz and launching leadership with nothing else going on. But, you know, it could be $200,000, $300,000. Does that make sense?
Which we want to spend some time on the blitz, like tomorrow afternoon, in between the Bernie thing.
Yeah.
We better do it then because we got the two groups.
Yeah. Everybody, if you have your calendar with you, look, put these dates down and just take a look at them for a second. I've been asking everybody to give me whatever dates that they might have conflicts with next year. For the BJJ guys, I took into account, the Worlds and the Pan Ams. So we're not on top of either one of those. The Pan Ams next year are March. In fact, the Pan Ams are the same time as the ATA Spring Nationals. So those are both the 11th or the 12th, 13th, 14th. One in Vegas, one in Irvine. So maybe we can...
11th of March?
Yeah, well, for dates, tentatively for us, I mean, this is, you know, barely in pencil, right? But take a look at February 26th, 27th, 28th, May 15th, 16th, 17th, August 21, 22, 23, November 5, 6, 7th.
That's for next year. Correct.
For next year. I tried to space out the events a little bit. We ended up kind of tight between the two this year. And as best I can come up with, this doesn't conflict with any of the major organizations that I've seen. It doesn't conflict with anything you've shown me on ATA schedule. It doesn't conflict with the big Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu tournaments. It doesn't conflict with the NASCAR tournaments and so forth. A quick glance, does anybody have an immediate problem with any of those dates? No? Good. Well, if you do, let me know. Tentatively, we're looking at this one being Panama City, Florida, because that's that big Navy diving school. It's the underwater demolition and salvage school. One of our Mile High Karate black belts is the commander of that. I think I sent you guys that letter that he had sent Master Smith. We haven't run that through his schedule. Master Smith is probably talking to him today. So if it works for their schedule, that would be Panama City. Alternative, we might do that one in May if it doesn't. But and then we'll get places and locations. As long as we're on the subject for a second, anybody have anything like West Point that would be really cool to do next year? Paul has given us a standing invitation to come to Allentown.
Can I ask you, the 26th is a Thursday in February, according to my calendar.
Oh, well. Depending upon, I was thinking with their facility, Sunday may be difficult. Hmm. Right? So it could be 27, 28, 29, or it could be 26, 27, 28. We're trying to figure out with that.
Okay.
training center. And with that, I'm not sure if it's going to be like this, where we find a hotel adjacent, and or whether there's actual meeting facilities on property or whatnot. Pastor Smith's going to figure that out.
Okay.
But anybody have any Paul, you're how far? You're what, 45 minutes from Atlantic City, 30 minutes from Philly, an hour and some from New York?
No.
So,
we're
my spatial around here is
we're 2 hours from AC.
Okay.
We're about an hour from Philadelphia.
Okay.
An hour and a half from New York City.
So you're actually closer to New York City than Atlantic City.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So and so you're actually you're actually sort of between Philly and New York, closer to Philly.
Yes,
is that right?
It's literally a triangle.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Master Smith and I actually drove right by there. We didn't have time to stop when we did that play when we came to New York. That was a quick trip. Did I tell you guys that story with Walter Anderson? Did you? Walter Anderson just did an off-Broadway play, which, like, I mean, we're talking, you know, off-Broadway means like a block off-Broadway in this case. But his storyline is he was a high school dropout who was a sergeant in the Marines with Joe Louis in Okinawa, training in martial arts in Okinawa with Joe Louis, right? So he and Joe Louis became lifelong friends. Walter Anderson became... He went up the chain, but he retired as the CEO, publisher in chief of Parade Magazine, which is the number one distribution magazine in the world, right? 10 million distribution. And when we went to New York, it was the debut of his Broadway play, or, you know, off Broadway technically, I guess, the debut of his Broadway play. So Jeff Smith and I came up for the day to go to the debut. But it was really interesting experience because we're sitting there and they had the play and the after party. But Walter, having been at that level for so long, and he's been very involved in the martial arts, and he wrote a program called The Confidence Course, by the way. And he's written five different books. He and June Reed are good friends. He and Joe Louis were lifelong friends. June Reed was on the cover of Parade Magazine at one time with Bruce Jenner, and I mean, that's when Walter was in charge. But Jeff Smith and I were at the play, and we're talking to this nice lady. Turns out it was Marlo Thomas. So it was Marlo Thomas and Phil Donahue were there, and, you know, I'm sure a lot of celebrity playwrights and, you know, one thing or another that we didn't know. We were also then talking to a gentleman who was a Annapolis grad, former Secretary of the Navy, who was a senator from Virginia, who's been discussing him running against Hillary in the Democratic primaries. And a couple, so he had like this A-list group of celebrities, and then he had this whole group of Vietnam veterans, because the play was a World War II veteran comes home. His dad's a World War II veteran. The son comes home from Vietnam, and it was all about them bonding over shared bad experiences. It was very interesting. So those dates tentatively look pretty good for everybody's calendar.
Well, November 5, 6, 7 is also another Thursday through Saturday. And if you don't have any reason for
right.
it, you maybe really mean 6 through 8.
It could be. You might tag Sundays in there. So 8. For everybody here, is Thursday, Friday, Friday, Saturday, or Saturday, Sunday better for you generally?
Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Okay, so you'd rather do Friday, Saturday, Sunday?
But for the inner circle part, which is better, like
yeah.
Sunday, because you guys stay for everything anyway.
Well,
what
we've been doing is rotate. So what we've been doing is like every other meeting. So like this one, inner circle was first. Last time it was last. I kind of thought last time worked out fairly well, especially after the boot camp. Because sometimes it's better to get the smaller group together to recap after a couple days. But does anybody have any preference, whether it's Thursday, Friday, Friday, Saturday?
Fly out for Saturdays, of course.
To leave Saturday? Yeah. I get both. You know, I get you know, I want to be back, you know, back home on Sunday. Or
I just find there's less travel messes on a Saturday. Seems to be a low volume as far as flying.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
seems like it's less, my experience. Less.
Sunday night tends to be a busy time. There's a lot of business.
Yeah,
travel.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
I have preferred having Inner Circle beyond Saturday, Sunday. And then
after
it's
the
smaller, it's earlier. I like that better.
Right.
Yeah, after.
So you like Inner Circle the day following rather than
right.
the day ahead. Okay. Well, all good feedback. So, again, the question where I get distracted was any great ideas? Again, Paul, you had volunteered. I thought it was a fantastic experience to do Elite MMA during one of the events. I mean, in Houston, I was very pleased with both Visible Changes and Elite MMA. I thought that was helpful. And in your case, we'd really have to be out in Allentown because there's no easy way to be Manhattan or Philly from where you're at, right? I mean, it's an hour either way.
Right.
Is Atlantic City still going to be there next year, or is it?
They lost like five casinos.
Yeah. Well, last time I was in Atlantic City before they lost five casinos, that I can't figure out any reason why I'd ever want to go back.
You have a casino in Allentown.
Do you?
Oh yeah. It's very nice.
You know, for me personally, Atlantic City was. All of the things I hate about Vegas with none of the things I like about Vegas, right? I mean, you know, the only thing I can tolerate about Vegas is, like, it's kind of like glitzier Broadway shows and that type of stuff. And what I don't like is I don't like assholes, I don't like cigarettes, and I don't like gambling, and I don't like slot machines clanking around. And so, you know, you double the asshole factor coming to Atlantic City, and then, you know, you have all the other stuff, right? I mean, you know.
Have you asked other people if they're interested in going to Allentown? Because I don't need a casino. I'd love to go.
Oh no! That's why we're talking about it right now. Yeah. No, I don't need a casino. So you know, certainly from behind the scenes, over the last couple years, we've done behind the scenes at Sterling, behind the scenes at Elite MMA. Both were probably the best of the year from the standpoint of rubber meets the road. You know, it'd be fun to come out and do Portland and do something with your school, Jeff. And you've
yeah.
got a kind of a unique relative in that just you have so many different things going on. And Portland's a hell of a nice place to be.
Portland, Oregon.
Portland, Oregon.
The best out there.
What's that?
Summertime.
Sure. Yeah, we don't want to be midwinter in Allentown either. Probably spring or fall for you.
And what about Annapolis? You were talking about doing Annapolis.
Annapolis is certainly a possibility. We have some good ties with Annapolis as well. And Annapolis is right outside of Washington, D.C. So, what's it, about an hour?
No, it's less than an hour. From downtown D.C., it's over an hour.
Okay.
The Beltway, it's less than an hour.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not suburban D.C., but it's not far. Right. It's pretty much now. It's very similar to this to New York City, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so
people
about
commute.
About
people
the
commute
same.
From Annapolis to D.C.
Mm-hmm. What's that?
People commute from Annapolis to D.C.
Ned Muffley always did. He lives in Annapolis and works in Bethesda. Mm. So... I would hate to do that.
Yeah.
Be driving an hour and a half a day. I think that's more typical in California, where they live like, you know, they live in Fresno and commute that way or something ridiculous. Any other bright ideas on some venues that would be? I have a whole list that's been on my wish list, but always looking for something new and different.
You know, one thing we did for like the leadership, sell it. And make it more convenient, we put it between a beginning class and an intermediate class, and it's a specialized class. We specialize in whatever activities they want,
right?
And that way both groups get to see it, mostly like book it to both attend. So if I have somebody in the lower rank, they can come to that class and leadership, but somebody in a higher rank can come.
Yeah.
And it seems like that, and then sometimes they get credit for more in one class in one day.
Sure. That's a good way to structure it. The other thing I've seen now that you've said that is like taking a beginner and intermediate, which is what you're talking about, or an intermediate advanced, and then plugging the leadership component in between the two.
Yeah, sandwich.
So that this class comes early, this class stays late. I personally don't like that as well. But you do bring up another thought, which is if I'm in our case, Greg, I pulled gold and put it here. So this used to be 3 months white, 3 months gold. Now it's 2 months, 2 months, right? So now this is a 4 month class, but they don't move out until they have renewed. But once we put them into the rotation, they've got enough of the basics here that they can go into this smoothly. There's never a transition issue. But then the question is, if I'm a white belt and I have two or three more months before I get to move into that, do I get to learn new leadership material or new black belt club material at white belt? And the answer is sure. So what you can do then is, just like you're potting off all the crazy stuff now, is you can pot off all of the people who are renewed. And over here they can be doing rubber chucks or sticks or something fun. And, of course, when you do it, I mean, 75% of your rationale for doing it is everybody else is going, why can't I do that, right? Just like your logic of it's right behind the beginner class so they all get to see it, right? It is useful to structure it so that they're all seeing the different stuff going on and they all want to be able to do it, right? And I've seen a couple of like launching a leadership program having problems with it. But it's kind of like it's behind the wall over there, and they never see it, and they never lust for it, and nobody else is doing it, and they don't get it. Does that make sense? Okay. Anything to add to that, or any other questions about that? But certainly Jeff, I imagine Eric and Hai as well. But let's talk to them about how they're structured, you know, the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu curriculum. It eliminates a lot of problems.
It's actually like that.
Yeah.
It's on a 2 month process.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I have one question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because you just brought up something. I do exactly what you just said, which is like take them behind the curtain.
Right.
And my logic was everyone sees the people get their sparring gear or their scrimmage or whatever. But do you think, and I did that time wise because we overlap the classes, and I only have like one big mat with a curtain and then a separate little room, which when you have staffs, you can't fit them all in that little room.
Right.
Do you think it's worth it? I do extra 15 minutes between each class that we do the extra upgrade. Do you think I should, instead of overlapping the classes, reschedule and just keep them on that main mat where everyone can see it?
What do you mean overlap? You mean so basic and your black belt club, where they start at the same time, so the basic finishes and they walk out and they see the black belt club doing their stuff?
Yeah, so say my first class is going on, and then when they're done, the people that are in the upgrade go to the side,
and
another class comes in.
Uh-huh.
So both classes are seeing these people go to the side, but they are at the side doing whatever they're doing.
They're at the side, but they're not necessarily seeing what the other guys are doing as they move.
Yeah, but they know. I mean, you can hear the scrim of sticks. You can see the sparring. So everyone's kind of seeing these people doing that. But it is behind a curtain. I mean, we close the curtain, and then this class is getting warmed up while this class is getting their 15 minutes of upgrade. Do you think that's enough?
I have a comment on that.
Go ahead.
My first comment would be, you know, I used to have when we were testing like 360 students at one of my schools, the one that I was teaching at when I started, we had a 2,600 square feet. That's as big as it was, and we put a wall in and had a window and a shade. We could do all that stuff. I mean, we could do the same thing where we could move classes around. We had lots of classes, and if I was doing my curriculum now, I would have ripped that wall out and had one floor for a couple reasons. One is, I only have to hire one instructor necessarily if I set my curriculum up right so that I can do everything. And having two floors and having people on one floor and another really doesn't necessarily add value unless you're trying to break the curriculum up into smaller chunks. Now, it would add value with little kids and big kids potentially if you've got that many of each grouping and you want to keep them separate. But if I set my curriculum up right so I only need one instructor, so one criteria for me is I only need one instructor to run the class. If I have another one, that's okay. They can help. But if that guy's sick, I don't have to worry about it. One instructor can run the class, and they can run any ranks that are or any ages that are given to them. So, you know, if there's a way to, like we talked about with curriculum, and maybe that it's something always after something like this we can look at, is restructure the curriculum so you only need one floor, you can do it all on the main floor, then it just seems like it would simplify your staffing issue and simplify your schedule.
Lot, like you're looking an hour more than...
Well, not necessarily. Not if you structure your curriculum so that it makes the... If you can't fill the floor, then that's true. So if you can fill, I mean, instead of looking at it like I've got this breakdown of curriculum, I've got all of these other things, just look at it, I've got 300 students and they need to come in twice a week, that's about 600 slots. I got to fill that up. They generally come 45 minutes. I divide all that up and that's how many spots I need to fill them. What you teach in that may just depend on which program they're in. So you've got the equation of the slots you've got to fill, which is the number of classes that come in times the number of students, divided by the number of programs that you've got in each of those groupings, and then that determines how many classes you have. So ideally, you know, like right now, on the floor right now, you've got, 30 in one class and 20 in another. If you could handle 50, but it would push everybody into one grouping, then you wouldn't have to have two floors. Keep the thing open, and you've got one big, huge, super exciting class going on all the time.
So,
I don't know if that makes sense.
Maybe I'm confused. So you're saying that you have a 6 to 6:45 class, for instance, and then a 6:30 class to 7:15, and they overlap for 15 minutes?
Yeah, we overlap our mat chats, too. So say, like, my 6 o'clock class, what
right.
will happen is the 5:30 advanced class, green and brown belts, just ended. Then when they're done at 6 o'clock, then they'll go get their club over in a different room. At 6 o'clock, I've got my family class. For 15 minutes, we do our mat chats, our promotion, our theme, bullying, verbal judo, whatever we're doing. And then at 6:15, class starts. Then when that class ends, that's only a half-hour class, physical. Then at 6:45, between 6:45 and 7, I have the upgrade. So sparring, everyone would spar. Now, at that time, we do. There's no overlap, but that's the only time there isn't an overlap. And then my 7 o'clock adult class comes.
So you pull the curtain back for the one that there's no overlap?
Yeah,
and
I
then
usually
put it
the
back.
Now unless the classes are too big. But I only have 200 students, so we're usually... The only really big class is the family class. But that takes me two instructors at least to teach that, because what I do, and this is the best thing I ever did, is I now have any family member can come to that class. It's the biggest class I have. So it's kind of a problem because all the tiny tigers, little dragons are there.
Mm-hmm.
So we do the mat chats, and then we take them to a separate room. But the parents love it because their kids get to... The whole family can be in that class.
Right,
the convenience.
Why aren't all the other classes that way?
I think a lot of, like, I have my 3:30 Little Dragon class, and a lot of people
right.
just can't make it because they work during the day.
No, it's a different, answering a different question. How are your classes broken up now?
Okay, I have a 3:30 Little Dragons, Tiny Tigers, and then at 4, I have my after-school kids come out.
Okay.
So they're, like, 7 to 12. but right at 4, okay, so the AMP class starts at 4, and the 3:30 class, Tiny Tigers, Little Dragons, that are in club, go and they get their club for 15 minutes. Club is our upgrades.
Right.
So they get that. Then we have the 4 o'clock class go to 4:30. Then at 4:30, we have the people that are in club from the after-school program, which is about half of them. They go get their club. And at 4:30, I start my mat chat with the 4:30 class. So both classes sit together, and they get the mat chat. And then 4:45, I start my new class. To 5:30, same thing, and then we have a 15-minute overlap of mat chat.
What are the breakdowns from there? Do you have a class schedule with you?
I think I could probably pull it up on my computer.
Well, I guess I'm
it'd
not
be easier for me to visualize.
I'll write it out.
You did some of Dave Kovar's stuff, right?
A little.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The Kovars always gravitated towards having 5,000 square foot school with two classrooms, just to overgeneralize. And I always found them gravitating towards overcomplicated, very minimal net profit. I mean, their profit margin has always been tiny. And anytime I've ever gone beyond what you're talking about, the single floor, is I always found. And then this obviously doesn't apply to, you've got a Tai Chi school and you've got a Muay Thai school and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu school basically under one roof, right? But if you're just running one curriculum like you are with Things to Do or you are, is all of a sudden when you start trying to get too complicated, what you have a tendency to do is the expenses go through the roof and the revenue doesn't match it, and all of a sudden you're overcomplicating your life for too little money, right? And I've seen, again, Dave is one example, but Dave and Tim and Steve LaValle both always had this problem, is they always looked good on the surface, and then when you dug into the numbers, there wasn't money left at the end of the day. You know, I mean, there was some, but I mean, not in relative proportions. It wasn't. You know, we would sit down and compare P&L side by side, and you know, and you know, I remember one time the top line revenue I had in 5 schools was the same as LaValle had in 3 schools, but my net profit was running 35% of the bottom line, and he was losing money. And so, you know, you've got to be really careful about how you complicate it. In your case, that overlap with completely different things going on, it is complicated by the fact that you have that daycare thing going on at the same time. And, you know, I think I would certainly love to see the daycare in a separate room facility, you know, kept different. But the other overlaps of having two things going on at the same time, I think just overcomplicate your life. And you'd be better off to just, as he said, if you have 20 here and 30 here, figure out how to just have 50, right? And have them all doing the same thing. It's really no more difficult, no more complicated than the rotated curriculum deal, right?
Well, and I would say a way to kind of conceptualize the problem, because a lot of times we get to this point and we were talking for Greg's stuff and everything is like, well, I don't know how I could do it some other way because it's already like a big mess as it is.
Yeah.
But what if you only had one instructor? Like, what if you only had one person and you didn't have that curtain to go?
Well,
the curtain
we used
broke.
To have it.
Yeah.
Right. So.
But our days were longer.
Well, okay, and what if you had to put all the parameters in there and you wanted to finish at a certain time? You know, then the only way the days could be longer is if you weren't filling the floor all the time. So if you can fill the floor all the time, then you're still producing that much volume of classes being taught.
That's not making sense to me, because whenever I do the club, see, I'm trying to make the upgrade convenient. Every time you come to class, you get to stay for 15 extra
minutes. Well, that might be something that might be something on the blank piece of paper. You may not be able to do that. I mean, see, that's the thing. I mean, if you didn't to me, there's a value.
What she's saying is what everybody's doing, is the upgrade is convenient. You get to do it when you come to your class. Now, the difference in between what I just described is you're coming to different classes once you're upgraded,
right?
Not coming to the
right.
same class,
right?
So what you're saying is, if I'm enrolled for a year and I'm enrolled to Black Belt Club, we both come to the same class, and then there's 15 minutes, kind of like the leadership Black Belt differentiation, right? And you're doing that all the way up through.
Yes, sir.
Well, how many people do you have that have been there for 6 or 7 months that aren't in at least Black Belt Club?
Not very many.
Right.
Most of them upgrade within 2 months.
Right. So you don't need that beyond the beginner class.
You don't need that club differentiation.
Yeah. That could go away.
Well, no, because I do have like green and brown belts in that area.
Right.
I probably have, because I don't make it mandatory. If you've been here with me for a year, you don't have to go to club. You can stay and renew for another year.
Oh, well, that's... I would get rid of that.
Kill
that.
That's one good to do Monday, like when we were talking about. The best way to implement stuff is just do it, boom. And you could grandfather them all in there just immediately in or something, you know, do something with them. Or during the renewal blitz, you can make it
a renewal blitz.
Just clean it up. Because that is adding. I can see what you're saying now in that case. You're adding more time to your schedule because you've got to accommodate these 10% of people who aren't really playing ball by the rules that you've established. And most of the time, those people, it's like, you know, the best example, when I started my school, I was following my instructor's lead, and he was doing everybody month to month if they wanted, or you could sign up for 6 months, you could sign up for a year. And one day I just got rid of the month to month ones, and hardly anybody quit, but the ones who stayed actually were better. They had a better attitude because now they're committed to doing something. And a couple of people quit, and I didn't care. It's like, you know, I think
You're going to quit anyway. It's just whatever their excuses.
Yeah, it was just, yeah, and I'm trying to hang on to that situation without any real good reason. So that would solve a lot of the problem, too. But, I mean, you know, one instructor.
Just get rid of that. I mean, just, you know, once they go from the beginner class to the next level class, they're all in the next level program.
And that's just a value to me, is that I can teach the class with one instructor. If I need multiple instructors to teach the class, then can I solve that problem? Maybe I can't. In certain curriculums, I probably couldn't. There's certain situations, maybe that's not the case. But, you know, our guys are all taught. If there's just you, you can handle the class.
Yeah.
And then if there's more instructors available, or an assistant, or an instructor
program. Where, like, in his situation, you just have yourself.
Right.
And you have... You know, really, you have six different levels, even if it's only two belts.
Right, right.
You're not rotating, and it's a mess.
Right, right. Whether you have multiple, and you know, I always find if you have one instructor in class, the class becomes more synergized. There's more group value. There's more energy. So it's just, but that may not be what you're talking about. But if that was the problem
set
you had to solve,
Greg, is if I only have one instructor and they test every month, and so a third. And now I've only got one instructor. I end up in the, we're going to teach the whole class the form that those guys learned 3 months ago, he learned 2 months ago, she learned a month ago, and now, you know, most of the class is bored, right? Or I try to figure out something where I can do it with all of them, and then you come up with something that looks like rotating curriculum, but you're not teaching them their normal curriculum, right? So you've got to eliminate those complexities. And, you know, Jan, what you're describing, so many times over the years, it seemed like a good idea at the time syndrome, right? Where there's something that is going to complicate things, but there's a rationale, and the rationale makes complete and thorough sense. But there's a solution over here that eliminates 90% of the complication, or there's a solution over here that made complete sense at the time, right? And I can't tell you how many times over the years I've looked back at something and said, well, God, I feel like a moron now, but it seemed like a good idea at the time, right? And you've got to be vigilant on getting rid of all the complications, right? And there are some places where there's enough of a financial justification to make it more complicated, right? So, you know, like when it comes to the marketing, you know, somebody who's just doing email follow-up is leaving a bunch of money on the table. And you can automate text messaging and voicemail, but you got to, like, actually hand it off and get somebody to do direct mail and some of these other things. But is it worth a live person calls them and the mail goes out? Absolutely. So in that case, in a sense, we overcomplicate it by having it hit a lot of different directions, but the multiples are big enough that it makes sense, right? But so many times when it comes to class structure and so forth, simpler is better and more complicated is worse. And simpler oftentimes ends up with the student gets better, they're happier, the instructors are better, and you need less staff and your payroll goes down, right? I mean, so there's all those different pieces that go on. And, you know, and the cynics might look at some of this stuff and say, well, they're just doing that to make it easier to staff so they don't have to pay as many people. Well, yeah, right? But it also has the converse effect of it's easier to operate the school, the students are happier, the students make better progress, everything else. So, but it seems like the solution to the main question is you get rid of this idea of having clubs, because that's, You want it to be there's people who are committed to train to black belt, people who haven't committed to train to black belt. And then there's a couple different pieces to it. Even the terminology clubs devalues what it is you're doing. So I would be careful about how you use the terminology. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That should be the normal. There's like normal is the black belt club, and then special is leadership.
Which
and
has that word built into
and
it.
Everybody
but,
right.
Else is in the basic.
Yeah.
Leadership. They're elite.
They're either enrolled on a trial enrollment to evaluate this, or they've been approved to train to black belt, and they're enrolled to black belt or into the leadership program to get there. I mean, you know, and you simplify the Jay. I'm not sure Jay's going to be here or not, but Jay, who's doing the new school, he's the attorney, right? he had sent me this detailed list of questions about what Black Belt Club means. But mostly what he was trying to do is go back to the old thing of you get a 10% discount on retail and you get this thing.
Oh, yeah, that's a terrible idea.
I mean, it's a terrible idea.
It's super complicated.
Yeah, it's got to be I'm committed to train to Black Belt and therefore I'm allowed to train to Black Belt or I'm not. And then there's a couple different ways to get there above that.
Yeah. Simpler is better. We said that in rotating curriculum.
Yeah.
We said that in terms of the schedule. It should be that way in terms of the sales process. You hit on something that I wanted to follow up on that, you know, to ask them for money once and then you ask them for money to upgrade and not ask them for basic and then Black Belt or an intro class, then basic and then Black Belt Club and leadership and ask them for money 16 times.
Right.
You know, simplify the number of times we ask them for money or automate it so they don't feel the payment comes.
Yeah.
You know, there's lots of ways we can simplify things.
Well, like with the equipment, I mean, either give it to them as part of the upgrade or have one package. You know, don't sell them a thing and then sell them a thing and then sell them a thing. You know, the whole pro shop thing always seems to be a bad idea.
Yeah. I wish I could get Century to auto-deliver like in a multi-level almost where you get an automatic delivery. Every 2 months you got a shipment of the gear that they needed. Because if you had to do that, then every couple months they get a prize.
Yeah.
You know, but we can't. Then that becomes complicated. I'm not sure that's worth the value in the. But it would be a good retention tool, and they'd be buying the same thing.
Yeah, that's why we love complicated but automated. Right.
Right.
Set up once and just runs forever.
Can you spend a moment and kind of break out the numbers on
everything?
Should look
not quite.
issues with. This is pretty basic. One of the things I'm still getting really tripped up on our schedule, I know with the rotating curriculum and stuff, that will kind of help, but right now our class sizes are actually getting to the point where I know logistically we should be able to handle more students.
Right.
But right now we're averaging in some of our classes 40 students, and my space is really limited to probably like 30 logistically, even if we're teaching the same curriculum.
Oh, I think you have more capacity than that. I mean, you have a big floor.
Right. And so that's what I'm
there,
looking for is how
how many active are you running right now?
We're just over 210.
Yeah, I mean that shouldn't.
Well,
be
yeah, I don't know where we have rubrics. I've seen it, but you know when we I think right now our problem is we have I keep adding classes thinking that's going to alleviate the break people out a little bit more. So we have only 6 days of classes for them to pick
right.
on. But the problem is they're all coming 6 days a week, most of them. So I either have to rewrite my Black Belt Club to say
you have a majority of that. That's a real. I mean, do you know that for sure? I mean, you think that they're all
right now? My Black Belt Club average attendance per week is 4.5. So
I've never heard of that number.
Black Belt Club is
4.5. The average Black Belt Club member is coming 4.5 times a week.
That's
a lot.
That's
a lot.
Yeah. Are you charging $500 a month for those guys?
$250.
Not bad, but
I
mean, 4 days a week.
We don't have leadership yet. We just have Black Belt.
Oh man. You should upgrade all those guys. I mean, you got some psycho crazy people.
I've been browbeating for a year to do leadership.
Yeah, 4.5 times. That's
well. That's
what's
that's
your
unusual.
Average?
What?
Two and a half.
Yeah,
yeah mine two.
Yeah.
I just scheduled two.
Is there?
Do they have to do that for the curriculum? Like, then it almost seems like they should be bored. I set my curriculum up two times a week for 2 months, and that's how much stuff the average person should be able to learn. So if you had your guys coming on almost 5 days a week, they're like it's more than they need, or maybe it's not.
Well, I mean they're proficient. They're all passing. We won't have any problems with.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because they're coming in every day.
Yeah, we're doing 3 month test cycles. But
what's unusual, Greg? And you're talking about predominantly the kids market. What's unusual is the biggest problem you get. And you've got a good demographic. The biggest problem you get tends to be the opposite. Soccer mom doesn't want to drive the kids that many times a week down, so it's unusual. And there's got to be something in the culture where you're setting them up to think that more is better. And because again, it is unusual. I rarely have I can't remember ever coming across a number where they were coming that many times.
Even more than three average seems really weird.
Well, the only time I've come across that is like some of the MMA guys who are like, here's the package where you get to come 5 days a week, and here's the package where you get to come 4 days a week, and here's the package where you come 3 days a week, and if you really want to be cool, you do, you know. So.
But then it's culturally pushing them to do that 5 days a week, like they don't get as much
which
emotional
reward. Which is
counterproductive,
reward. Yeah.
Right.
Anyway.
Unless
maybe
you're charging $1,000.
Where they want to be?
Well, I mean, he's got a very, you know, very nice family environment. Everybody has a good time. But there's, I hate to say you want to wean them off of it because it's one side it's not a bad idea, a bad deal. But really, I mean, I think the most I've ever run personally was about 650 active in 2,400 square feet. And the number that Tim Kovar and I came up with over the years was one active student per 7 square feet was about reasonable capacity, which puts 2,100 square feet, 300 active. The most I've ever seen was LaValle back in Syracuse, and he was running like 650 out of 1,300 square feet. And, I mean, it was a zoo. And the irony is he then went from that to 7,000 square feet, and his expenses, his facility expenses went up 8 times, literally 8-fold, and his gross dropped. But so he would have been better off to have the crowding problem.
I think your curriculum's too complicated. I think the students, for pressure, they feel like they need to come in because there's no reason.
No, his curriculum's fine. His structure is FUBAR. If he fixes the rotating curriculum thing, that's gonna fix a lot.
I guess I would question, just as a question, if I only came twice a week, would I be very successful at my testing? If the answer is no, then the answer is whatever's happening, whether it's too much curriculum or the way it's getting taught in class, we all assume we're teaching everything really good. You know, if I only came in twice a week, then would I be successful? Would I look good at my testing or not? And if the answer is no, then the guys who are coming 3 or 4 times a week are feeling like they need to, you know, and they're dedicated students. There's nothing wrong with that.
I think it's more of a competitive kind of, they're trying to get one up on the other end. We've definitely got that culture of...
Are you letting them test faster?
I'm letting them test faster if they're in the black book mode and they have the classroom departments.
I would get rid of that. You're gonna do just like college. You're gonna do midterms and finals, and so you're gonna test every 2 or 3 months. The minimum is like in 3 months, 24 classes. But if you have 46 classes, you may pass with an A+, and if you have 24, you may pass with a C. But it's all the same, because now you do yourself a disservice by getting them to cram all the classes in unless you flipped your. I mean, if you did. You know, the old June Reese system that became the Tiger Showman system that Bill Clark was pushing, which I don't like, but, you know, if you're selling them packages of lessons and you're trying to get them to burn through them, then you do yourself a service, right? But if it's just they're going to pay this much a month, and then when they get to their black belt, it's the next renewal, you're doing yourself a disservice, right? And frankly, you're doing them a disservice.
Well, yeah, I don't want to test them.
Well, why not? I mean, if somebody was super, if you came in to Master Oliver School and you know came in 3 hours a day for a month, you'd probably be ready to test.
Well, we essentially the way we phrase it is that the way that our character stuff is implemented within the class is they have to catch 2 months worth of the character stripes to.
So he's got them on a 3-month testing cycle, but they can test in 2 months if they get enough lessons. Mm-hmm. And then they're coming to more lessons, so they're testing every 2 months rather than every 3 months.
I think you should make it more complicated. I'm just kidding. That was a joke. I mean, this is a good thing for all of us. I mean, sometimes part of being in this room is that what are the parameters that we should be shooting for? And if we don't come together like this, we don't know what those parameters are, like, you know, how many times a week people should come in. And if you do it independently,
well,
it's hard to know if
you're
right.
Problems like he's having, they would never dawn on us to address, because it's just kind of one of those weird evolutions.
Right. Which are totally natural, I think, when you're by yourself, though.
Yeah, yeah.
When you're by yourself trying to figure this stuff out, you know, I've done a lot of this stuff, too, and, you know, so, and you said you've done it, too, and we all kind of do that when we're not
kind of
working operation.
It's just that is, I'm looking at it like, it's a problem, it's a happy problem, but I got to fix it because we're starting to devalue, you know, the classes are too big.
Well, it depends, Greg. Let's take it out of our context. If I'm an attorney and I'm billing at $500 an hour, well, I'd rather be billing you 5 hours a week than 2 hours a week, right? So I only have a certain number of hours to go around, but if I'm getting compensated on a per-hour basis, I want as many hours as possible, and if I can get it from one big client, that may be better than from 20 small ones, right? And we're really in the same business, right? So there's a cost that comes with running a class. But now if I consume the classes at three times the rate without a comparable increase in what I'm paying, now what's happening is your per class value is going way down, and now you're having a crowding problem, all kinds of other things, right? You're having the opposite of fitness industry thing, right? Fitness industry thing is sign you up, hope you don't come back to crowded facilities, right? And in your case, you're having the opposite, which is they're paying $250 a month, but if they now come 6 days a week, they're not paying $750 a month. They're still paying $250 a month, right? So there's two ways to solve it. One way to solve it is the lesson package, right? Is you're buying, Black Belt Club is 300 lessons. And then when you run out of lessons, you have to renew. And if you run out of lessons in a year, that's fine.
That is how it's written.
Yeah. But it's not how you're implementing it, right? And in practical terms, the way you have it written is I get to the end of the year and I've done 300 lessons. They would freak out if you said, well, I know you're structured for $250 a month for another 2 years, but you have to pay that $5,000 now because you've abused your pack. That completely flip, right? The Bill Clark, Tiger Shulman, June Reed model was, it's this package, it's how many lessons. And then they were, Clark most recently, were pushing, chew up the lessons as fast as possible so you're going to renew next. But the way you paid for it was different too, right? So,
you ran that system for a while, didn't you? And you didn't like it because?
It was difficult for us to... We let them test when they were ready to test. And our testing numbers fell down.
Mm-hmm.
When you're testing, in our school, and I assume it's in most all schools, when your testing numbers fall down, your students drop off.
Right.
Because they're not testing, they're not improving.
Yeah.
Did not like it. It probably was the beginning of us going down.
Yeah, yeah. It's a real, but again, it adds complexity. You know, it's the simpler we can keep things, the better it is, and that's why that one, everybody was real excited in the ATA. A lot of people were super excited about it.
We put in more members in the ATA that 1 year than anybody in the whole organization.
Mm-hmm. And yet you didn't keep them because of the way the structure was working.
Right.
Yeah.
And we worked our butts off, but we didn't keep them.
I don't like that structure for other reasons. But to solve your problem, see, if you went to rotating curriculum, that's going to make the classes easier and make the quality higher, okay? And if you phase them out of, don't do a cold turkey. You know, the goal is not to take the most enthusiastic students and piss them off. But if you phase out of it, so the next wave coming in, there's a test every other month or every 3 months. You test every 3 months. You've got to have a minimum of 24 classes. Well, what happens if I have 60? You still test every 3 months, and you probably pass with an A+, just like a college student who studies more, right? And get it out of being a self-paced curriculum, right? In college, I took a couple of self-paced. You know, as long as you take all the tests and do all the stuff, you know, I had a semester class that I finished in 2 weeks one time. But in most cases, that's not the productive way for people. And you could start it with, you've got to test every 3 month cycle. There's no changing pace for the first year. So going into the next year,
you don't let anybody do it, and then you push it to 2 years, and then from 3 years up, I mean, it's fine, right? So, but if you just gradually shift the culture out of, I'm trying to take as many classes as I can to test ahead of time, right? The contrast to that, which is kind of what you've got built in, is what Jeff Smith does with his summer camps. Is he does rank advancement classes or camps, right? So now you know in 1 week you're going to get enough classes to test for a belt, and I found that fine, but it's a different dynamic, right? But just wean them off of feeling like they can test ahead. But if you put in rotating curriculum, restructure the classes, get it where, depending upon what you prefer, 2 or 3 month cycles. And then on that 3 month cycle, you've got to have at least 24 classes, but if it's 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, you know, that's fine. I certainly wouldn't let people be coming more than twice a week if they weren't in Black Belt Club, but that's not what you're doing, right? So, but if they're not incentivized to be there 5 days a week, by thinking, well, I can get to Black Belt in 18 months rather than getting to Black Belt in 36 months, right? Then it'll fix some of that, right? But I mean, 200 students. I mean, you have the same thing as same number as Jan's talking about. Are you running classes 5 days a week or 6 days a week?
Six.
Okay. So you got 6 days a week. What time in the afternoon are you starting?
We start 3:30. 3:30.
Okay, 3:30. And if each class was an hour, and some of them are shorter, you've got 4:30, 5:30, 6:30, 7:30. So four classes, maybe five a night, right? So even if it was four classes times six, and you probably have more on Saturday, that's 24 classes. 24 classes into 200 people, right? I mean, that should be more or less 400 class attendances. So what does that divide out into? It's, what's 24 into 400? You've got your calculator there. I mean, it's less than 20.
17. Yeah, it's less than 20, right.
Yeah. So, I mean, that really should end up being about 17 per class on average. And you're always going to have a scheduling gap, right? So you've a certain number of classes, and there's a boom coming through because you did maybe not many enrollments in July, but a lot in September. But I mean, that's with one instructor, that's completely manageable. And if it was 30, it's completely manageable. And if you were at 300 active, then that would basically mean that number of classes is an average of 30, and that's fine. So, and you have how many square foot?
We're usable space. We're right about
total square foot.
2,800.
2,800. Okay. I mean, so you're fine with, I mean, 300. It seems to me that both of you would be at kind of prime at 300 students, right? That doesn't mean that's your capacity, but 300 is a place at which the retention is best, the personal attention is best. You can maximize the revenue per student. You can run $1 million a year school at 300 active, and it's frankly easier to run $1 million school at 300 active than it is at 600 active, right? So I mean, if that was the target, now, obviously we're talking martial arts, not kickboxing and stuff, but I mean, there's no reason why you're not $1 million a year school, right? And a lot of the $1 million a year school piece is going to be simplify, get where the system, the class is easier to teach. You've got plenty of new students coming in. Your revenue per student isn't where it needs to be, and there's some other things that are overcomplicating, right? So your life is more complicated than it needs to be. I wanted to go back to what you said, Jim. How many kids' classes do you have where parents can't attend?
None.
Okay.
Parents can attend any class they want. They don't usually attend the Tiny Tiger's Little Dragon.
Okay. Well, I misheard you then. Okay.
Yeah, they can attend any. But my family class is just really popular. Once we opened it up and put the Little Dragons, Tiny Tigers in it, all of a sudden it's packed. And we're thinking of doing that 3 days a week because 2 days a week we're packed.
Well, I don't understand the difference then.
The difference was before, even though a parent could come to any class, they don't usually come to most of the classes. They usually come to the adult class. And then, and most of the reason is because the parents work in the evening and they can't even make it till 6 o'clock. And I only have two family classes at 6. Tuesday and Thursday evening is the only evening classes we have right now.
So in other words, you don't have, it's the other way around. You've got some classes. Those are classes that the kids can attend that are later. But the other than that, you've got adult classes where the kids can attend.
Yeah, well, I have two Tuesday and Thursday evening, just two, 7 o'clock, adult-only class. But I have more people at my family, more of my adults go to the family class than go to the adult class now, which is really weird, I thought.
I would think it would be weird the other way around.
Really?
Yeah. Yes. And again, it depends upon which direction you're coming at this from, right? So if you're coming at it from Jeff's direction or from Team Took's direction, is if or if you were at the Krov School, like Houston Krov, they're adding a kids program, right? So if you're an adult school and you're adding a kids program, it's a completely different dynamic than if you're a kids school, right? Because if you're in the dynamic where most of the marketing you're doing is towards kids and most of the adults you have are parents of the kids, then the parents would rather come down with the kids, right? From the opposite direction, 32-year-old coming down to train for themselves, they don't want to come into a class of 7-year-olds, right? But that, you know, if it were me, if I can come to a class and I'm training with my daughter and my son, I would much prefer to do that. I might only consider it because that's something that we could do together, right? So where I think, and like Melanie Schumann was one of them that took people off in a weird direction, is there are the kids that are so young that it's difficult to manage in the bigger class because they're not quite keeping up, right? So the little ninjas, little dragons, whatever. But so the 3, 4, 5, sometimes 6-year-olds are difficult to have mainstreamed into that other class, and it's useful to have a class that gives them additional support until they're able to move into the class, right? But after that, is anyone who's coming in predominantly with their kids enrolling the parents, they mostly will want to come to the family classes, right? Now, the exception I've seen to that is what you're saying is, let's say you have mom and dad wants to take class, and dad works till 6, and he wants to come to a class at 7 or 8 in the evening that's late enough, and he can't make it to a 4 o'clock class, right? So if you don't have enough classes that are pushed later enough in the evening that they can come, then you change the dynamic just because of schedule, right? But I have heard it differently, which is you only had 2 classes that families could come to anyway.
No.
Okay. Is everybody doing that, where all the kids' classes are family classes?
No. Is it?
No? It's something that we found is if you have like the 7 to 12-year-olds, let's say, in a class, and then you don't have adults in that class, is if you just open those up and change the way you refer to them and make them all family classes, then it makes it much easier to get the parents of the kids enrolled, right? And again, the dynamic is if I'm an adult coming for classes for myself, I don't want to take a class with kids, but if I'm bringing my child and now I can add on and come to the same classes, is it gives me a lot more incentive to do so, right? And the mistake that a lot of us make is think we can divide up the family and have them, like your number, but have them coming 4 or 5 days a week, right? So if mom has to come Tuesday, Thursday, and the 5-year-old has to come Monday, Wednesday, and the 7-year-old has to come, it's again the crazy thing on Melanie's deal is, you know, a huge number of ours are at least 2 kids of the family taking class together, and a lot of them are a parent. And so now if they had 2 days a week for this person, 2 days a week for this person, 2 days a week for this person, we would almost all cases get one of them, not get all 3, right?
Even if it's the same day, even if they both all come on Tuesday and Thursday,
yeah.
It's different times, they got to leave, they got to manage the kid being it, sitting in the waiting area.
Yeah.
Even if they're consecutive classes, that becomes problematic.
And you know, I have a lot of that, so you just gave me a good point. Even though it's open to them all, I call it a kids class. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm going to change the schedule and say family class
right.
for this rank,
yeah.
family class for this rank.
Right. Well, that's exactly right. Or you designate adult-only classes as adult-only classes.
Well, I still have
yeah.
those.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Yeah.
Do you find that the adults in the kids' classes are having fun?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It seems like it'd be hard to keep them interested or working out with kids.
Not at all. Not at all. Go ahead, Paul.
I will say we were hardcore against having parents, you know, in the kids' classes. And but as soon as we switched it, we were saying, why didn't we do this before? Because the parents, in many cases, learn better when it's a kids' class than they do in the adult class.
And vice versa. You see the kids progress a lot faster than the parents are.
Yeah, yeah. And Jeff, that doesn't mean that you can't separate out the kids from the adults in some portion of the class, right? So, you know, the adult may, you know, in the kids portion of the class, you may want to do a little bit more fun and games. The adult portion of the class, you may want to do a little bit more cardio type of workout, right?
So you're having them come at the same time, but you're kind of teaching two different classes.
No. Not the whole class, no. just some parts of it.
Yeah. Yeah. A mistake I've seen even some of our guys make is try to, like, take all the moms and do a cardio kickboxing class, right, rather than just do the normal class. And all I'm saying is you might have it where you take the kids over here and they're going to do dodgeball, and the adults go over here and they do bag work, right? So if you're going to have a time when you want to separate them, you tend to gravitate towards the adults get to do more workout type of stuff, and the kids do a little bit more play type stuff. But the dynamic is that the adults in that class are the parents of the kids in almost all cases. So then even when the kids are doing play stuff, sometimes the parent becomes the helper, and so the parents are throwing the dodgeball or whatever at the kids or so forth. And as long as the adult is also taking class, learning the same thing, learning the same curriculum, it works just fine, right?
And those times that are split can be minimal supervisory times.
Yeah.
So you don't—it's not like you're teaching them technical material or making sure they do stuff exactly right. It can be minimal supervisory time, so it's easier to have the group with one instructor.
You know, and what I've always found is, given the option of I come to an adult-only class, I come to the class with my child, probably 75% gravitate towards doing the class together, okay? The only time that I find many of them coming to a separate time is the mistake that we made by, like, all the kids' classes are done by 6, and the adult classes are after 7, and now you're forcing the attorney who works long hours to come down at 9, right? So if you force them through scheduling to come down at the adult-only time, they will, right? But as long as you're conscious of that, then it works just fine.
Logistically, as a parent, if I can take class when my kid is taking class, I'm not taking anything away from my family. And I can sit in the lobby, or I can have fun.
Yeah.
I hear that logistically, it sounds great, but I just look at our kids' class compared to our adult class, and they're night and day in 2 different classes, and it just seems like it'd be hard to merge.
We've kind of done like a hybrid interview. We have, you know, the regular classes, but we do have an adult-only class at night. And it's real popular. We have a lot of families that will do both.
Yeah.
But then it gives them a choice. You know, then they're not forced into, like you're saying, oh, I got this, or I'm taking away the time from my family. And we've got a, you know, pretty big call about just do that at all costs. And it is. It's different. You know, structured a little bit harder, more hardcore, more crap.
When you say there's night and day between the kids and the adult class, Jeff, what do you mean by that specifically?
Well, the adults work a lot harder. I mean, we train a lot of people that are competing and fighting, and they're not going to want to be in a class with an 8-year-old. You know, they're either doing jujitsu and they're out on the mat and they're sweating hard training with somebody else for 2 hours, or, you know, or they're out there sparring with somebody else doing stand up.
Well, let's start with the first caveat. If it's an adult who came in on their own, they don't want to be in with kids, okay? If it's a kid who came in and you added the parents, then they're fine with it, okay? So you have an awful lot of adults who are coming in on their own, And now you don't want to ever merge that class. It'll be a disaster. Okay? Number two is overall, you may need to think in terms of upping the game for the kids. Because I found historically the 8-year-olds are every bit as capable of performing at the same level as a 27-year-old, right? So it may be the standards for the kids are lower because that's the expectation. And if you put, and I'm not talking about they do, you know, full contact fighting or something, right? But if you move the standards up for the kids, especially year two and year three, you may find that you equalize that out anyway, okay? Certainly don't take the two and merge them, right? What I would do is take all the kids' classes, just start referring to them as family classes, but the kids beginner, when you enroll a kids beginner, you work on a good system for enrolling mom or dad, right? What I found is if we're doing a pretty decent job, we can enroll half of the kids, we can enroll mom or dad. Historically, we're about 75-25, so 75% are moms, 25% are dads. Although, like the Sterling School is 50-50 now, right? So I've historically found we're adding more moms, right? And the demographic trend is typically, you know, it's mom and dad making the decision together, but really mom's making the decision, and mom's driving the kid back and forth, right? So, which is an important thing for us to remember marketing-wise too, right? All of our kids market advertising has to be aimed directly at mom, right? Because, you know, still, yeah, she's making the decision. I mean, that, you know, for all of the, you know, social upheaval that people are claiming, that hasn't changed.
So, I guess my question, this would be the issue, and just get numbers of input. With jiu-jitsu, you have to have a partner.
Sure.
So now you have
right.
A full adult who's trying to do an arm bar on a kid. It's not they cannot
do it. Well, yeah, you can't partner them together.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
So we line up our classes by height.
That's no different than free spar.
No, but what I'm saying is now you have a class, a family class. If you don't have other adults there, that person's
right.
Not going to be able to participate.
Sure. Well, if you have, yeah, it's the same problem if you have an odd number of people, right? Same problem. So you have an odd number of people and you have, doesn't matter what the odd number is, right? You have 9 people, you have one odd man out. You've got to solve that, right? How do you solve that?
I'd have to get another adult or I'd have to be their partner.
But then you can't manage class.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, but how would...
Well, you have that happen every class. So...
So that's what I'm saying. If you have adults, you don't have that problem. When you start...
No,
yeah,
you do. No, sure you do.
Yeah, you do, because you still have an odd number.
Odd number, they just rotate. You do
same deal.
Reps,
same deal, right? So if I have... Let's say, theoretically, I had 32 in class, and I have 5 parents and 25 kids. Mm-hmm. Well, I've got 5 people... Partner, odd person out, you know, rotate with them, and then you rotate with them, right? I mean, so same way you solve having an odd number of people, right?
I mean, you're...
I got it confused. I thought it was...
Yeah.
You were having it almost like a mommy and me or a daddy and...
No, that, and it's important to treat the parents just like students, not like they're there for their child, right? So,
I mean, I wouldn't enroll a parent unless I had definitely 2 that could be in the class and they were close in size.
Well, what if you were starting your school from brand new and you didn't have any students? Would you enroll 1 person?
No, I'd have to be their partner, but it's a lot easier to manage when I already have 30.
Yeah, but if you were starting from scratch and you had 0, you'd enroll the 1 person, right, and you'd deal with it. And then you'd enroll another one. But that's how you do it with the family class, too. If you make these family classes now, only 1 parent comes on the first day, and then eventually more come, and you have more partners. You wouldn't necessarily partner with kids. We just line up all our classes by height anyway. We don't go by rank or anything. That way the bigger kids are sparring the other kids. Like you said, it's the same as free sparring. It's no different.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want an 8-year-old sparring a 30-year-old.
Or kicking you know.
Or holding a bat. Yeah, right.
It's the exact same dynamic. And, you know, the right now, how many active kids do you have in the location?
50, 60.
60 in one and probably 70 in the other.
Okay. And how many adults?
Well, that's just in jiu-jitsu.
Let's just deal with jiu-jitsu for a second.
And
so,
jiu-jitsu and adults, yeah. Probably one, probably 150 in the other one.
So roughly, let's just deal with round numbers. So roughly 150 adults, 50 kids, right? It's fair enough. And so of the 150 adults, how many of them are parents of the kids that are in class?
Not very many.
Not very many, right? So right now, the dynamic doesn't make much difference because you've been mostly bringing in adults for themselves, kids for themselves, right? But now if you change the beginner kids class, do nothing else. Just change the beginner kids classes and start calling them all family classes, right? And now go through all of the beginner kids and try to get mom or dad to enroll with them, right? And you'll have a trickle because they've already been allowed to think that this is for them, right? But then when the next intros come in, you start them from the first class with, well, most of the kids have mom or dad that train with them. You're certainly not required to, but we suggest that. At the very least, why don't you go ahead and take the first couple classes with them, and you'll get a chance to see what the class is all about and how it works and so forth, right? And now what you should find once you get fluid at it is for every 10 kids that you enroll, you probably add 5 adults, right? Now, in essence, you have a 50% jump in the enrollment. Well, Greg, what's your ratio? How many parents are enrolling on average?
About 30%.
30%. So that's a room for improvement.
And, well, yeah, I mean, yeah. As far as just parents, but then you know the overall adult, our mix is we're right about 50% adults.
Right. Yeah. But now, if this month you did 10 enrollments of kids, you just added 3 or 4 parents, right? And now you got 3 or 4 more enrollments you wouldn't have had otherwise. But also, the kids are going to be better at. You're going to have better retention because the families that are training together are better at longevity. There's a lot of other positive things that happen. But it's easy to implement, right? Don't mess with the adult classes. Don't change the adult program. But in the kids program, just start thinking about all as family classes, right? And really, you just want to start at the beginning because it's new intros enrolling, getting the parents to enroll with them and come at the same time, right? Because see, you can tell already what your dynamic is. 150 adults that aren't there because of the kids, 50 kids that are there that mostly don't have anything to do with the adults, right? And what a lot of the adult programs will think is, well, I had a kids program, they'll all bring their kids. Well, the reason they would bring their kids is if they can train together, but if they can't train together, then there's always that disconnect, right? So, anything to add to that?
I mean, I think it would help. Yeah. I think it would definitely help because we get so many parents that they think they know what jiu-jitsu is by watching it.
Right.
They did it. They would probably like complain a lot less and get off to their kids a lot less too.
I think the funniest thing I ever saw you do was when I visited your Westminster school.
Yeah.
I thought you were crazy. He had a stack of uniforms up at the front, and I watched a couple parents walk in, and he just grabbed the uniform.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't even give them a choice. He just said, here, go put this on. And they did it. They enrolled. And I tried it actually last month.
Yeah.
I just went through our, you know, the parents that are kind of sitting on the edge of their seat.
Right. Yeah.
They were ready to jump in. They just turned the uniform and said, go put this on, jump in class. It worked. You know, they jumped in.
I was doing a consulting day in Indianapolis one time. But that was the dynamic there, is they had never really worked on adding parents, which is not, you know, a lot of people haven't. But he had an idiot program director sitting in the office, so I got him to go in the uniform closet and there must have been, you know, a big class, 50 people in class, and all the parents said, I said, here's what I want you to do, pull all those uniforms out that are collecting dust and just go give every parent a uniform, tell them to go put it on. He goes, well, I asked him if they want a uniform. I said, no, just give them a uniform and tell them to go put it on. And they did, I think, 8 enrollments of parents that night. And, of course, you know, you had the
she refused because she just had knee surgery, and the crotchety old grandfather said, leave me alone. But, you know, I mean, 8 out of 10, it was just fine, right? And in your kids' class, and again, it's hard if they're like all brown belts, right? Because now I'm going to try to add mom and dad, but they're not going to train together. And that, I guess I shouldn't preface it that way. You can still get a lot of those parents, but it's easier if you're doing it with beginners, so they're all going to train together and come at the same time and so forth. But just, you know, just go on Monday, and every beginner's class, go give the, you know, and you've got expensive uniforms, right? So what, you know, whatever you want to do. But, you know, give them something, get them out on the floor. Because what your uniform's costing, what, $90 or something like that?
Anywhere from 50 and
90, yeah.
Wholesale.
You know, in our case, we're buying them for $10 wholesale or something like that. So I give them away like candy. You know?
I wish.
We can maybe come up with a super cheap beginner uniform. I mean, you guys got to have them strong enough that you can throw people with them. So,
yeah.
You know, I don't know how you'd solve that, but.
Give them a karate uniform to try it out.
Yeah.
Hopefully,
yeah.
Don't rip in the first 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Sir, yeah. I like the verbiage you use, and you were doing that on the initial enrollment, like most of our kids have their mom and dad train with them. Yeah, so say if the parent wasn't expecting to do that and they give you a little feedback.
Sure.
Or, and they don't want to do it. Would you just give me uniforms? Say, well, just try it for free, or do you try to sign them up? Where do you go from after the verbiage? Where do you go there when they start objecting a little bit? Which most of them do. They don't even want to get out there and do the trial lesson, is what we found. But we didn't. We don't use that verbiage.
Well, I think the main thing is just being assumptive, mm-hmm. right? As opposed to like me asking a yes or no question. I say, Ms. Jones, we're just going to have you take class with Joey today. Well, this is just for him. Well, I know, but we always do that in the introductory class so you get a chance to see what's going on and you're familiar with the program. You can make a better decision whether it's going to be something good for him, right? Yeah, that's just the way we do it.
And then they do the introductory class, then when you go to sign them up, do you just assume she's going to sign up with them? That's kind of the question.
Well, no, that'd be the same language is, you know, now most of the kids have one of both parents that train with them, and obviously as you look at, now what, you know, you're making it up until it's true, right?
Yeah, they go out there and there's no parents there, they're the only tall one.
As Zig Ziglar said, you're just telling the truth in advance, right? That was his line, right?
I'm not lying.
Yeah. That was his line about goal say, you know, you're just telling the truth in advance. But in the enrollment, it just becomes, you know, now, and Ms. Jones, you guys are going to do class with him, aren't you? And the dynamic in that conference becomes entertaining because a lot of times it's dad telling mom she should do it with him, right? And some portion of the time, he's right in that he has a condition for which he can't, right? Meaning, dad says, well, you know, like you used to do. Well, I travel 20 days a month. So the idea of me being able to do this consistently 2 or 3 times a week is difficult, but, you know, Marge, you're going to be driving here twice a week anyway. You know, why don't you do it, right? And a lot of times that becomes, you know, the instructor's logic also is, you're going to be here anyway. You know, rather than sit on the sidelines and watch, wouldn't it be more fun to participate with it?
We've used the take it away clause
yeah.
in that too at the first group of us is we plant the seeds and we say, hey, you know, most of our families, we offer family discount, they go through all that motion and we say, normally what we'd like to do is we'd like to get the kids started first and then go back and you know, let them kind of get a little head start, get the feel of things, and then next month you'll go ahead and run. So we kind of take it away a little bit and say, next month this is when we go back after.
I don't like that.
No.
No. I like, you already took 2 classes and you're going to be on the 3rd class.
Yeah, takeaway close is different. A takeaway is, that's
a delay the sale and kill half of them. Line.
That may be why it's 30%.
Wait, stop saying that and we'll get you to 50%.
Right.
Yeah. I'm not sure that answers your question, but.
Well, I guess the other part of it would be, So I just did the intro with my kid.
Right.
We close them on the first interview, so it might be a little different. But so say now you're in here and you're closing us, and you assume that I'm going to take, well, you're going to take away, well, I'm not sure, I'm not ready to sign myself up. Would you just say, well, let me give you a uniform and try it free for a month? I mean, that's what I would do. Is that what you guys would do, or would you?
I don't think I would go there quite as quickly, but I would end up there if necessary. Is, you know, I would go, well, what's your concern? And a lot of times they'll say, well, this is for his, you know, we wanted something for him, right? And so that's the logic. I don't want to take anything away from Billy because this is like Billy's thing. And that's an easy one. Well, Mrs. Jones, really, you want him to thrive at this, right? Well, of course. Well, what we find is the kids do a lot better when mom or dad is in class with them. And frankly, you know, in this context, you know, about 75% of the parents who are taking class with their kids are mom. And not only is it not going to take away from his experience, it's going to help a lot. Because now you guys have practiced at home together, you've learned the same material, you can help him study at home. And frankly, it's one of the few activities that you do. I mean, you know, Ms. Jones, you know, most of the time you're schlepping the fold-up chair and sitting on the soccer field or something. It's one of the few things you can be actively involved and participate with him. So sometimes that level of objection you overcome pretty quickly, right? And then you've got to think, what are the other objections? A lot of times they have some physical thing they haven't discussed with you yet. So I have the knee surgery I had or one thing. So it gives you a chance to bring that up in the open. And other times it is just, I'm not too sure I'm comfortable, right? And then it lets you bring that up. Well, yeah, I got to tell you, after you've been in class for 3 or 4 classes, you're going to be completely comfortable. You know, a lot of people are just, you know, embarrassed to be doing something physical, especially in front of an audience. But the reality is, after a few classes, you get more comfortable, and the two of you will be having a lot of fun together. It'll be a good family activity. So, but
the kids almost always want mom and dad to do it too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's.
Yeah, wouldn't that be fun to have mom in class with you, Billy? Oh, yeah. You know. The kid says, no, you're slapping. You know.
No.
I would just work a little harder to overcome the objection, right? And ultimately, if you get to the point of, I'm just not sure that I'm going to become, you know, well, here's the uniform, it's free, let me just plan on you taking class with him for the first month. And if you don't want to follow through from there, that's fine.
While you're on this topic, could you give us your thoughts on the pricing structure for discounting for family members?
Yeah, I really like the, it's full price for one, it's full price for two times two, and that's the family price.
Say that again.
It's full price or full price times two is the family.
Yeah.
And again, I freely admit I borrowed that from Bill Clark. Took him a couple years to convince me.
So
I like it.
4 or 5 people could come for the cost of two?
Yeah.
Even in the upgrades?
Yeah. In reality, you don't get many of those, right? I did the same thing you're doing,
you
Greg,
mean,
on that
you
one.
You don't get many of the 5 people coming
right.
in. You do get a lot of family ones, but you don't get,
yeah.
you don't overburden your school with a bunch of families of 12, you know?
Yeah. And, I mean, there aren't many of those. And in reality, you know, it's not the third cousins and it's, you know, I mean, it's mom, dad, and the kids. I mean, you know, they got to be under one roof. But I did the same thing you're doing on rotating curriculum. I spreadsheeted it out and looked at the student body and figured out how much we were going to lose and all that stuff. But what we were doing at the time is this full price, 25% half price, right? And I'm going the, you know, how much am I going to gain? How much am I going to lose? By the time you netted it all out, we had a lot more. There were two in a family that I actually had raised the tuition on. And then if we added a fair number of the moms, we also added, there's now two kids, and frankly, his mom is not paying anything extra, right? But there's a benefit to having mom in class, right? There's a benefit for the feel of class. There's a benefit for Joey's longevity. There's a benefit for referrals even, right? So if I have the same amount of money for two or three, but I've got two kids and mom, any day of the week I'll take, add mom in, because it improves our dynamic overall, right? And it improves the dynamic with Dad, but I mean,
I don't know if you do this, but one of the things that Master Oliver advised me, because I was having a hard time getting the kids and the parents into the class, he said when they call up in the very first place or when you talk to them, say, we ask that the parents join, what I say
right.
is join for the first two classes for their intro,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, to make him more comfortable. And so I that's where I finally broke through, because I could not talk. And it's not that I still need work, because when I've only got one kid and the parent still has to pay full price to get in, I still have a problem getting them in. So I still haven't broke, but it really made a difference.
Makes at least more of them try it.
Yeah,
they really
need to be there for those first two classes and be in the class. And one of the other problems that I had before was with one or two parents in the class, nobody ever wanted to do it. Now that all the kids that are coming in, you know, for their first one or two classes have their parents there, it feels the normal thing to do.
Yeah.
And there's less resistance to them, you know, joining the program. But I still have a problem with there's one kid, and particularly one kid and one parent,
right.
and maybe she doesn't have a whole lot of money, and she can't see paying equal money to what the kid's paying for her to take the class. And I really would like her in the class. She's
yeah.
great. I'd love to have her in the class. And I haven't figured out how to overcome that.
Well, you know, you may have any good thoughts.
Yeah, I actually charge them cheaper because it takes more to teach your kids. We're not charging them as much. We should increase the price on the kid.
So in other words, if you have two kids,
I'm
else
not sure I liked his response. But
yeah, I don't. I know. But so what do you do?
I will leap off of his comment, which is, for some reason, martial arts schools in the past, and I still come across it, are charging less for a 5-year-old than they are for a 12-year-old, less for a 12-year-old than they are for an adult. And I always think that's a really bad idea. And including the little ninjas, little dragons, whatever. I'd rather them be on the same price scale everybody else is. And truthfully, the younger the kid, the more the parents are willing to pay, right? You know, at a certain point, you know, okay, they're a teenager, right?
But that's actually why I have
yeah.
a problem now,
mm-hmm.
because even the kids have like half an hour class,
yeah.
it's what, you know, they look at it as expensive, and so why should the parent want to pay that much, you know, to join it? They just can't see the value in it for them.
Well, that may be a yeah. Well, we want to take a. Greg was going to check on the restaurant. Let's give him a second to get back. My bladder's telling me we've been going too long. he was going to check and see if they have. Who had breakfast in this restaurant this morning? It's really a nice restaurant,
mm-hmm.
but on some days they have a lunch buffet, and we've made the mistake in the past, like in Cheyenne Mountain, we almost made the mistake that day, right? Because we broke 10 minutes before the buffet was over, right?
Oh, no.
So you're going to check and make sure that they do. We've been here before about 2.5 years ago. When you go out the front door and go immediately down to this little street, there's all kinds of stuff right there, right? I mean, that's immediately off of an army base. So there's everything from a McDonald's to a pizza by the slice place. There's a bunch of little stuff just a block out the front door. There's two bars, restaurants here. One that is right there that overlooks the Hudson outside. Last time we were here, we did kind of like we did on Sunday at Cheyenne Mountain. We did that on Sunday on the rooftop bar here overlooking the Hudson. It worked out pretty nice, other than it was kind of noisy. But you ate in the bar last night, right? It was mostly just kind of burgers and whatever. The time we were here before, all of the food service in the hotel was wonderful. Obviously, the views are wonderful and everything else. Is everybody's room okay? The rooms are kind of, the hotel is, what, 150 years old, so, mm-hmm. you know, you've got to deal with that. I think they've upgraded quite a bit since we were here last time. But I'm not sure that answered your question fully, but yeah, if you prep them on the call. Now, we're gonna have class time scheduled for Joey, just so you know, Ms. Jones. We recommend that both parents take class with him. And sometimes they say, well, this is just for him. Oh, I know. But with all the kids, we recommend that you go ahead and actually you and Dad participate in the first couple classes just so you get a good sense of what it's all about. And obviously, that'll make him less nervous. It's also a good time to ask for a referral, right? But then they're prepped on the way in the door, right? And then when it comes to actually getting them on the floor and taking the class, I never ask, right? So, okay, Billy, come on up, Mom and Dad. And if you get this kind of, oh, no, just, you know, go ahead and participate, take your shoes off. If you're putting him in uniform, go put this on. Well, no, this is just for him. Yeah, but, you know, we had to take the first couple classes with him.
Yeah, you know. You.
And occasionally you're going to get a legitimate, you know, a little legitimate objection.
Right.
Well, I just had surgery on my third vertebrae, and they told me not to move. You know, okay.
Well, not everybody's going to be able to do it
for different
reasons. But I think it's a great idea because if you can get 25% of them or 45% of them, that's something that we haven't gotten before.
Yeah. My number's always been 50 or 60%. You're running about 30% right now.
Actually join?
Yeah.
Wow. On the initial enrollment or eventually?
Initial enrollment.
Wow, that's awesome. So we're not even at 10% because we just don't ask.
Yeah, I'd say historically I've run 50-55%.
When you do that, sir, do you charge them anything? You charge them an enrollment fee?
I charge them just the same as the second family member, but if it's like again, so it's
if it's a third member.
If it's a third member, no. So again, I'll get Bill Clark credit on this one, but I just ended up with, you know, let's say the tuition presentation is it's $500 initially, you get a $300 discount, or we're using $600, but it's $200 plus the first month, so $447 now, $247 a month, let's say, right? You just double that as a family, right? So now if it's one kid and mom, you're just doubling that. It's a family enrollment, right? And then the fallback question, of course, is Carol's quandary, which is, you know, I've got mom who's just barely eking it out to get one kid. Well, I'd throw her in there for 3 months for free if I needed to, right? Just because I like the dynamic, and then a lot of times they figure it out how to come up with it after that. And certainly if you wanted to then do some kind of scholarship to get single mom in or something, you know, you can do that. I mean, it's a fine line because you want to not ever let that become price negotiation. But then in order to accomplish your objective of the family is training together, it's worth it, right?
So your beginner program, sir, is $247 a month?
Yeah. You know, I say that. I mean, that's what we're trying to get the franchises to do, and they're all independent owners, so therefore they all think for themselves, which is a bad thing. And actually our current price is... What?
I just asked my husband what you said, and he told me, and then I laughed.
Oh, well, when it comes to pricing, is it used to be franchise law. Right, a trivial, arcane legal point. But franchises could dictate a maximum that franchises could charge. They couldn't dictate a minimum. And it's the old consumer protection, one thing or another, right? That has changed. So now you can dictate a price, you know, overall. But the push-pull is, in our case, is it doesn't matter whether it's Peak Performers, Inner Circle, franchisees, everybody's charging too little. Right, so it's this constant get off your ass and you know just ask for it, right, and we have the same thing with franchises, right? The guys who have the lowest volume will think they're going to solve the volume thing by undercharging, right? Or all of a sudden some new school opens next to them and they're charging $99 a month and you want me to charge three times that? I mean, you know, you get all that same stuff, and all of it is you know our industry is BS, right? Now, there's lots of good examples. I read an article in, I think it was Fortune. It's either Forbes or Fortune. And it was about, of all things, Ringling Brothers, Bart and Bailey, the circus. But it was saying that in the economic debacle that's happened, is middle class families have less disposable income for entertainment. And this is, you know, I mean, this is a big business. But their solution is interesting because they've gone both directions with tickets, right? They've made the nosebleed tickets a lot less, right? So at the lowest end, instead of having to pop $75 a ticket, you can, you know, bring the family for $30 a piece. But then they also do, which, I mean, we just went to the circus Monday, right? Yeah, the circus celebrity tickets, right? Mm. So, you know, we dropped $550 to go to the circus because you got to be in the front row and you got to do all that. And it used to be they'd like load you up in the thing and the kids get to, you know, go around on the floor or something. But the way they're solving it is they're going both directions, right? So they're getting numbers by all the people who might not have spent it on that thing. They're doing a low price point. But then the people who will spend the money, they've got the higher end thing, right? And it's my argument for why all of us should have a $1,000 a month program. Is there's always going to be 20% of your student body that whatever it is, they'll pay it, right? So, you know, if you and you're not going to get most people to do it. I mean, most people you can get them to pay $500, right? I mean, because right now on our standard pricing, to answer your question, Jeff, is leadership is $497. And then we're calling it Master Club, but it's really Black Book Club, is $347, right? And my price sheet from 8 years ago was $197, $247, $347. I mean, that was, what, 1995, right? And I can go all the way back to when I started 30 years ago, and inflation adjusted the down payment that we're charging has actually gone down. And inflation adjustment, the monthly payment is about the same, right? So if you inflation adjust to what I was charging in 1983, it was the equivalent of $800 down now, because we were doing $330 down. And it was the equivalent of about $220 a month. And that then, by the way, was 90% adult market. That wasn't kids market. So that was most of the adult market.
We're good. We're good for lunch. Is that what you were going to ask?
Well, do they have the buffet?
They have the buffet for lunch, and it's till 2 o'clock.
Till 2 o'clock, okay. Do you guys want to take a quick restroom break now and then lunch break at 1:30, or do you want to take a lunch break now?
1:30.
Show of hands. Lunch break 1:30. Lunch break now. Okay, 1:30 wins. I'm going to take a restroom break. Anybody else who wants to take a restroom break, go ahead. Anybody who wants to keep talking, keep talking.
I got this one.